into reality.
It feels like, yeah, I can finally live life again properly.
It changed my life, yeah. It do change my life.
The Radio 4 Christmas Appeal, making a difference. On Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, on Sunday morning at 9:45.
And this is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Friday the 5th of December. This is Today with Amol Rajan and Anna Foster.
The headlines this morning, more countries could join a boycott of the Eurovision Song Contest after four pulled out because of a refusal to expel Israel, including Slovenia.
Our performers wanted us to get out, so in the name of Slovenian public, we are doing that.
We'll speak to a Eurovision historian about the impact of the boycott on the contest. And the government is pledging to stop children growing up in bed and breakfast accommodation as part of its plan to tackle child poverty.
Also on today's programme, the new president of the Royal Society, Professor Sir Paul Nurse, will be here to talk about the future of science and research in the UK. And the world-renowned pianist Lang Lang will also be with us. He'll be explaining how he's using music like that to help children with physical and mental illnesses. Before all of that, though, the BBC News is read for us this morning by Alan Smith.
The Eurovision Song Contest has been thrown into turmoil after four countries said they would boycott next year's event. Ireland, Spain, the Netherlands and Slovenia had wanted Israel to be excluded because of the war in Gaza. But a meeting of the European Broadcasting Union said Israel could take part. More countries could pull out, as our music correspondent Mark Savage reports.
This is the biggest crisis in Eurovision's 70-year history, with little sign that the differences over Israel's role can be resolved. Germany welcomed the decision not to disqualify the country, and the BBC said it supported the collective decision of Eurovision's member states. But there is still a possibility that more countries could pull out, including Belgium and Iceland. The chair of Slovenia's national broadcaster said the precedent set when Russia was excluded should be continued, arguing that no aggressor should take part. In response, Israel accused critics of trying to silence it. The former Eurovision winner, Dana International, said the decision of four countries to boycott was violent and insulting and added to hatred.
The government will say it aims to lift around 550,000 children out of poverty by 2030 when it launches its child poverty strategy this morning. There will be more help with upfront childcare costs for those on universal credit, and families won't be housed in B&Bs for longer than 6 weeks. Vanessa Clark has more.
Across the UK, 4.5 million children are living in poverty. Key changes in the child poverty strategy already announced include scrapping the two-child benefit cap and extending free school meals to all families on universal credit. Measures such as extending help with upfront childcare costs and extra funding for councils to improve temporary accommodation are expected to affect much smaller groups of people, according to the think tank, the Institute for Fiscal Studies. Children's charities have widely welcomed the strategy, but some say it lacks ambitious targets.
One of Britain's leading scientists, Professor Sir Paul Nurse, has said the government is shooting itself in the foot with its visa system for science researchers. He told BBC News that high fees were putting off applicants who were instead being welcomed by economic rivals such as China and Singapore. Supporters of the current system say charges help fund the NHS and address concerns about migration. President Putin of Russia is to hold talks about trade and defence spending with India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi today, on the second day of his visit. The two countries are expected to sign a number of deals, despite US pressure on Delhi to scale back its links with Moscow. Our India correspondent Arunade Mukherjee sent this report.
There were smiles all around when Vladimir Putin was welcomed by Narendra Modi, then a hug and a handshake between the two leaders. The message to the world was loud and clear. Delhi's relations with Moscow will not be dictated by US pressure. During the visit, President Putin and his delegation will hope to make sure India keeps buying Russian crude oil, a key source of funds for Moscow, which the US worries is being used to strengthen the Kremlin's war chest. Prime Minister Modi will be walking a tightrope, cautious that his proximity to Mr. Putin should not come at the cost of ties with Donald Trump which have been unpredictable so far.
The US military says it's conducted another strike on a boat in the Eastern Pacific suspected of carrying illegal drugs, killing four men. A series of such attacks has killed at least 87 people, and members of Congress have been briefed on the operations after they raised questions about their legality. A BBC investigation has found far more LGBT people than previously thought were subjected to electric shock aversion therapy by the NHS in England in the 1960s and 70s. Some medical staff at the time claimed the practice could change people's sexualities or gender identity. Hayley Hassel reports.
Survivors of aversion therapy describe being strapped to chairs and given painful electric shocks to their arms and legs. Those who were given the treatment as teenagers describe lifelong trauma, including physical pain, PTSD and depression. We found evidence of more than 250 LGBT plus people being treated with electric shock therapy by 1974 in NHS hospitals. Lord Chris Smith, the UK's first openly gay MP, has called for a formal government apology, and the BBC understands the government will now investigate the historic use of aversion therapy in the NHS.
A turkey breeder which provides premium birds to UK farms has been suspended from the Red Tractor Food Standards Scheme because of allegations of poor biosecurity and animal welfare standards. Hockenhull Turkeys in Lincolnshire says it's investigating. Here's our rural affairs correspondent, Jenny Kumar.
Workers were secretly filmed by the campaign group Green Britain Foundation, ignoring hygiene measures such as foot dips and mishandling birds. Hockenhull Turkeys said the workers had been suspended while an investigation took place. Its birds are bred for farms that supply luxury Christmas turkeys to shops, including Harrods. The department store said it didn't have a direct relationship with Hockenhull Turkeys and its supplier was urgently looking into any breach in standards.
The government has confirmed that pubs might be able to stay open until 1am if any of the home nations makes it to the quarterfinals or beyond in next year's Football World Cup. The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, says the party won't end until the final whistle is blown. And in cricket, England were dismissed for 334 in their first innings on the second day of the second Ashes test in Brisbane. Australia have started well, reaching 130 for one in their first innings. They lead the five-test series 1-0.
Alan, thank you very much indeed. More depressing cricket news throughout the programme, no doubt. But for now, we get hopefully slightly more uplifting news from Helen Willits, who's got the weather. Hi, Helen.
Hi, Amal. Well, it's low pressure moving in for the day, so it wouldn't be great to play cricket here in the UK in that sort of weather. We've got gales picking up in the west and heavy rain as well here. But there's some quieter weather first thing, at least, across southeast England, the Midlands, East Anglia and the northeast of England. It's quite chilly out there. Temperatures have fallen below freezing quite widely. And there's some thick, patchy fog. A yellow warning from the Met Office actually enforced for parts of southeast England. And there'll be the odd pocket elsewhere as well. I drove through some not particularly pleasant. Once that lifts, because the winds are strengthening, we'll see some dry and some quite sunny weather before the cloud rolls in and some rain arrives in the West Midlands around tea time. But only 6 or 7 today. Chilliest, really, in these areas. Despite that sunshine. Further west across Wales, southwest and northwest England, we've already got a few showers ahead of the rain. The wind will be picking up, and although dry to start for many, that more persistent rain gets into Cornwall and Devon this morning, Pembrokeshire too, and then it will push slowly northwards and eastwards to several hours of fairly heavy rain, and the winds pick up to gale force around the coast. It'll turn windier in the south and east as well. So temperatures around about 9 or 10 degrees. Northern Ireland also seeing that rain setting in through this morning. Several hours of wet weather through much of the afternoon here on those strong to gale force winds, around about 9 or 10 degrees. Scotland still has yesterday's rain to clear away from the northeast. Once it does so, some brightness, some sunshine, just a few showers, and some brightness elsewhere after a chilly start. But rain does get into Dumfries and Galloway later, again heralded in by those gale force winds. 5 to 9 here.
Thank you, Helen. It's just coming round to 6:09. Let's take a first look at the morning papers. And the Times today is reporting that ministers are prepared to hand over £8 billion of Russian assets, which are frozen in Britain, to support Ukraine. The paper says the move's part of an international push to increase pressure on Moscow, and that as much as £100 billion could eventually be released for Ukraine's war effort if the UK manages to broker a deal with the EU and with other countries as well, including Canada.
The Novichok Inquiry is the lead for the Daily Mirror, which carries photos of Dawn Sturgis and President Putin on its front page. The inquiry found yesterday that Mr. Putin was, quote, morally responsible for the death of Ms. Sturgis, who was poisoned by the deadly nerve agent in Salisbury in 2018. Dawn's blood on his hands is the headline.
Comments from David Lammy that leaving the EU has badly damaged the UK economy and that rejoining the EU customs union would boost economic growth are the lead for the Daily Telegraph this morning. The paper reports that the Deputy Prime Minister refused to rule out reversing the Brexit process during a podcast interview, but said that rejoining the EU customs union was not currently the government's policy.
The Guardian says five more contemporaries of the Reform UK leader, Nigel Farage, have alleged to the paper that they witnessed racist or anti-Semitic behaviour from him when they were at school. He denies saying anything racist with malice. The Daily Mail leads on Mr. Farage's attack on the BBC during a news conference, saying he turned the tables on the broadcaster, criticising some of its output in the 1970s and 80s, which he said would be considered racist, sexist and homophobic by today's standards.
And the I paper has spoken to Liz Kendall, the chair of the government's Child Poverty Task Force, ahead of the launch of its poverty strategy today. She, it reports, defended her party's tax rises in last week's budget. It quotes her as saying that it would be ignorant to call Labour the party of welfare, but that it is the party that backs kids and their future. We'll talk more about that child poverty strategy released through the programme this morning.
Time now is 10 past six.
There's been another US military strike on a boat suspected of carrying illegal narcotics in the Eastern Pacific. Peter Bowes, our North America correspondent, told me more about it.
News of this latest strike came on X, a post with video of the attack from US Southern Command, saying that on the orders of US Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, the military had killed four people in a strike on a suspected drug trafficking boat in the Eastern Pacific. A brief statement saying that this was a lethal kinetic strike on a vessel in international waters operated by a designated terrorist organisation, and that intelligence had confirmed that the vessel was carrying illicit narcotics and, it says, transitioning along a known narco-trafficking route in the Eastern Pacific. The statement, as I say, says that four male narco-terrorists aboard the vessel were killed.
And Peter, this isn't the first attack of its type. There was one in September that's been looked at the moment in closed-door hearings. What are we finding out from that?
Yes, well, this was, as you say, behind closed doors. It was for members of Congress from both the House of Representatives and the Senate, high-ranking members from the relevant committees, the House Armed Services Committee, the Senate Intelligence Committee. They were shown classified, unedited video footage of that strike, that boat strike back in September in the Caribbean. A double strike, it was hit twice, despite there being apparently two survivors from the first attack attempting to climb back onto the boat. Now, there have been questions about the legality of this taking place in international waters, allegations of possible war crimes, questions about the chain of command, who exactly gave the orders. So US lawmakers heard from the US Navy Admiral who's been leading the operation in the Caribbean, Frank Bradley. He told them that he had ordered the second strike on the boat, not Pete Hegseth, the Defence Secretary, but he said he never received an order to kill them all. He insisted, and the White House has said this as well, that the strikes were lawful because the survivors were still considered a legitimate target. Now, after viewing this video, there's been strong reaction, especially from Democrats, one congressman saying that the attack was one of the most troubling things that he's ever seen. Another, Jack Reed, a senator, said he was deeply disturbed by it and called for the video to be released to the public.
Peter Bowes, thank you.
13 minutes past six. There's a significant new idea or policy in the government's plan to tackle child poverty. Families who are stuck in bed and breakfast accommodation for more than 6 weeks will get financial help, including with childcare costs. Let's speak to Vanessa Clark, our senior education reporter. Vanessa, good morning. Just tell us a bit more about this idea.
Yeah, so we've already heard about, I suppose, the key changes in the child poverty strategy, you know, the scrapping of the two child benefit from April next year, which was announced in the budget, and free school meals. extended to all families on universal credit. Now, the government says both of these policies are expected to lift more than 500,000 children out of poverty, you know, the main bulk. But today, the overall strategy has been released. Task Force has been working on this for a year. And we've heard about some of the other measures, as you say, for the first time, including some on housing. Now, there were more than 2,000 families with children in bed and breakfast accommodation at the moment who have been there for longer than the 6-week limit. You know, I remember visiting one family and there was a microwave in one corner of the room. Homework was done on the bed. Everyone slept in the same room. So the government want to end this, and it has confirmed it will extend a pilot programme to stop this happening across 20 councils in some of the worst offending areas. There's also funding for 5,000 homes which will be used for better temporary accommodation. And then there's a legal duty on councils to notify schools if anyone living in temporary accommodation, you know, it has, the teachers have to be told, which has been welcomed. But some housing charities, including Shelter, say, you know, these changes are just a sticking plaster. They say we need to get children out of temporary accommodation and into a permanent home, including more social housing and to unfreeze housing benefits so more people can afford to privately rent. And children's charities have welcomed the plans, including the childcare expansion that you've mentioned. But some believe the targets should have been more ambitious and that more investment is needed.
All right, Vanessa, thank you very much indeed. That's Vanessa Clark, our senior education reporter. And we'll be speaking to Alison McGovern MP, the Minister for Local Government and Homelessness, after 7 o'clock.
It's 6:15 now. Two chief executives of major UK pension providers have told this programme that budget speculation led to more pension withdrawals than expected. So what does that mean for those people's retirements? Well, Felicity Hannah joins us with more on that and the rest of the day's business news. Morning, Fliss.
Morning, yes. So that's right. We heard from both Michael Summersgill and Mark Fitzpatrick this week, the bosses of AJ Bell and St James's Place, respectively. Just a reminder, this is what they had to say.
Hundreds of thousands of people drew down prematurely, so people's pensions have been damaged.
We did see hundreds of millions of pounds of additional withdrawals from pensions, and that's people who are at or around retirement.
So if budget speculation did push more people to withdraw from their pensions earlier than they'd otherwise planned, what could the long-term impact be on retirement savings? Let's ask Sir Steve Webb, who's the former pensions minister under the coalition government and now partner at Lane Clark and Peacock Consultancy. Sir Steve, good morning. I suppose, first of all, do you think that additional withdrawals were linked to budget speculation?
Absolutely. And in fact, this isn't the first time it's happened. The Financial Conduct Authority publishes figures on withdrawals with a bit of a lag. So we've got hard evidence for last year as well. And then large numbers of people, particularly taking out pots over £250,000. And that's very strongly linked to rumours about perhaps tax-free cash from pensions being capped. So this appears to be the second year in a row this has happened, and it's deeply damaging.
Because at the moment, you can take out a lump sum from your pension after retirement, after remind me what age?
After 55 at the moment, and you can take over your lifetime up to just over £250,000. And there were rumours this year and last that that could be capped, for example, at 100,000. So if you were planning to take out more than £100,000, many people thought, well, I'm not going to take the chance that the Chancellor might change that.
So what's the long term impact then on retirements if more people do opt to withdraw that money from their pensions earlier than they'd originally intended because of that speculation?
I think that's the key. It's the earlier than intended. I mean, if you are close to retirement and you're going to do it anyway, you do it a few months early, probably doesn't matter a lot. But if you do it years early, you can't just stick it back in again. You know, if you change your mind, if as has happened twice now, the budget doesn't reduce at the limit, then potentially, depending on what you do with the money and where you put it, potentially you trigger limits on how much you can put back in. So actually you just cannot rebuild it in quite the same way. And of course, if you take the money out and then invest it in a way that's less advantageous than in a pension, so less tax efficiently, growing less rapidly, then your long-term retirement prospects are damaged.
Because, I mean, you make the point, you know, people haven't necessarily spent that cash. They might have placed it into other savings and investments. So is it necessarily something we need to worry about?
I think it is, because, for example, you might say, well, put it in an ISA. Well, that's fine. But even before the budget rule change, you could only put 20,000 back in. And we're talking about people who've taken 200,000, 300,000 out or more. So it's difficult to recreate the advantages you had before. And I think that the wider point is, fine, the budget didn't actually reduce these caps. But what would have been wonderful if the Chancellor had said, And actually, we've looked at this and we have decided for this parliament, I mean, that's only 3 years, for this parliament, we won't muck about with the tax-free limits. And that would have given people just 3 years of stability. I mean, we are talking about something that's a lifetime decision. And is it too much to ask for 3 years certainty?
And we see so much speculation around budgets now, don't we? It seemed to start even earlier this year. Do you think that pushes people towards short-termism and kind of panicked movements?
Yes. I mean, you know, pensions for life, not just for Christmas, really. And so, if in the summer you see a lurid newspaper headline, I mean, I saw one this summer from someone who should have known better that said, I'm a pensions expert, I've taken my tax-free cash. And although our, you know, paragraph 17 said, I don't actually think there'll be changes in the budget, nobody gets to paragraph 17. So I think, you know, the newspapers have some responsibility here because they do stir it up, frankly, because they know people read these articles. But I think we do need stability in the pensions framework and budgets, unfortunately, the way we do budgets, don't lend themselves to that kind of long-term stable planning, which you need for good pensions.
Sir Steve Webb, thank you very much indeed. Now, the chief executive of Waterstones has told me he wouldn't object in principle to selling AI-generated books, provided they were clearly labelled. In the latest episode of the Big Boss Interview podcast, I've been speaking to James Daunt, who also runs the US bookseller Barnes & Noble and the smaller chain Daunt Books. Now, after 7 a.m, we will hear why he thinks the business rates reforms in the budget could result in more prosperous high streets and fewer empty shops. But we also talked about AI, and I asked James Daunt how he was using it at Waterstones.
It helps our customer service operation become more efficient. It helps us in logistics and how you deploy your equipment. But we don't use it in the shops at all. And we spend quite a lot of time trying to keep AI-generated content out of our, certainly out of our shops, but also out of our online operation as well.
Is that hard to do?
You can use AI to identify AI, and that's helpful. But yes, there's a huge proliferation of content, AI-generated content, and most of it is not books that we should be selling.
In fact, there was a report from the University of Cambridge just this month that shows just over half of published novelists in the UK say that AI could end up entirely replacing their work as fiction writers. What do you think?
I think it's possible that the sort of more generic end of publishing and writing, that's possible. I think hopefully publishers will avoid it. We as booksellers would certainly naturally and instinctively disdain it. But at the sort of more literary end, which is predominantly what we sell, I don't see that being the case. And there is a clear identification of readers with authors, and indeed booksellers play an important role in joining authors and readers. That does require a real person.
But we already see some really successful series of books, particularly children's books, for example, where there might be an author's name, but actually there's a team of writers just kind of churning this stuff out. And some of those publishers might think, well, AI could be cheaper and churn that out even faster.
Indeed, and I'm merely, as a bookseller, we sell what publishers publish, but I can say that instinctively that is something that we would recoil, and that we do feel that sort of one of the most important things is that one is connecting authors and readers, and it's really important that authors, you know, earn livings, and we are responsible citizens within this wider publishing industry of which we are a part, but we don't publish ourselves. So that is a discussion sort of held in places other than the rooms I'm in.
To be clear, then, would you never intentionally sell AI books in your stores?
We would never intentionally sell an AI-generated book that was disguising itself as being other than that.
But would you consider selling it if it was clear what it was?
Yeah, if it was clear what it was. You know, I think it's up to the reader to decide whether they want to buy it or not. Do I think that our booksellers are likely to put those kind of books front and centre? I would be surprised. But again, we don't dictate. And we don't dictate also around, you know, politics or any other particular issues around books. We try and cover everything and leave it up to the reader to decide or the customer to decide what they want to buy.
Could it lead to even more personalization for the customer, though? So if I tell AI that I love Twilight and War and Peace and it gives me a book about Russian vampires?
That's clearly possible. I think it's more likely to be happening in the digital world than it is in the physical world. To create a nice book, a nicely typeset, nicely printed, good designed cover, binding and all the rest. There's an immense amount of work and effort that goes into that. And to be doing that for an AI-generated piece of, you know, nonsense, I would be surprised. But, you know, who's to know? They're spending trillions and trillions on AI, and maybe it's going to produce the next War and Peace. And if people want to read that book, AI generated or not, we will be selling it, as long as it doesn't pretend to be something that it isn't.
James Daunt, CEO of Waterstones, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
And you can hear more from James Daunt in our Big Boss interview podcast on BBC Sounds. Now, from books to increasingly bitter bidding wars, Paramount Skydance, which has made multiple offers for Warner Brothers Discovery, has fired off an absolutely blistering letter to Warner Brothers, accusing them of running a tainted and tilted sale process that favours rival bidder Netflix over its own offers. And it's being reported this morning that Netflix is now in exclusive talks to acquire Warner Brothers studios and streaming assets. Emma Wall is Chief Investment Strategist at Hargreaves Lansdown. Emma, morning. It's all kicking off, isn't it? There's an escalating bidding war here. Can you just walk us through what's going on?
It is indeed the irony of the drama for people who make drama, but it's the context is really important. So in October, Paramount put in a bid for Warner Brothers for the whole business, which I think is the important part of the story. So that's the HBO Max sort of streaming service, that's the famous film and studios, but also the cable TV networks, which have been the part of the business that's obviously dragging on profitability. Warner Brothers initially rejected that bid, but then put itself up for sale. And when it did that, it attracted sort of rival bids from Netflix. Paramount came back again, and also NBC came in with a bid. Netflix has been this morning revealed to be now in exclusive talks with Warner Brothers, but the Netflix bid is only for parts of the business, and those are the parts of the business that are doing well. So the parts of the business that I've said before, so the film studios and the streaming HBO service. Paramount are saying that all along, Warner Brothers had favoured Netflix, despite it being not as good a deal for shareholders because it breaks up the business. Whatever happens, you can expect the antitrust regulator to get involved, because whether it's Netflix that's successful in this sort of part bid, or indeed Paramount comes back for more, this will create a global mega power in kind of broadcast yes. entertainment, which the regulator will want to look at.
It's not so much a drama as a soap opera, isn't it? is it unusual to see a bid publicly attack a sales process like this briefly?
It is. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if this sort of thing goes on behind the scenes quite a lot. But actually, you're sort of tainting your offer if you go into sort of a public spat. And indeed, don't forget these businesses are listed. So any kind of negative narrative has weighed on the share price of the business too.
Emma Wall, Chief Investment Strategist at Hargreaves Lansdown. Thank you.
Fliss, thank you very much indeed. It is 27 minutes past six and time to say good morning to Jonathan Ledyard, who has got the sport for us. And Jonathan, you're going to tell us that there's magnificent news from Australia. No, you're not.
I wish I was. I was hoping to bring you word of a glorious morning for England's cricketers in the second test in Brisbane, that Joe Root had gone on to make a double hundred and Australia in reply were 29 for six. Sadly, the reality, as Amol has just hinted, is more gloomy. England added 9 runs to their overnight score, so all out for 334. Root finished on 138, not out. Since then, the sun's been shining on the home batsman. Let's go live to the Gabba and get the latest from Henry Moran. Morning, or even afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. Yes, it's not been the morning that England were hoping for. They lost the wicket of Jofra Archer after around about 10 minutes of play to be 334 all out. And since then, the ball has gone to all parts of Brisbane, and Australia have raced to 130 for one off just 21 overs. It's been messy from England's bowlers. It's been messy with the gloves from Jamie Smith as well, dropping Travis Head on just 3 off the bowling of Jofra Archer. Head was eventually dismissed for 33, but it is Jake Weatherald in just his second test match who has passed 50 for the first time, 59 from 56 balls. He's hit 10 fours and a six, and Manus Labuschagne at the other end on 27. So Australia fighting back hard in this first session of day two.
But the drop catch seems to have dented confidence, doesn't it? England rather draining and not, as you say, performing as they should do. It's messy, to quote you.
It is, and there's just that lack of a zip we saw on the first day with the ball in hand in Perth. England really felt like a unit as that fast bowling attack was everything that England supporters hoped that it might be. Jofra Archer bowled magnificently at the start of this innings, got that opportunity, but when that catch went down, there was just that sense that the deflation on a flat track against a batter that did so much damage in the first match could really take the wind from the sails. Yes, Travis Head is out, but there is just a feeling that Australia are motoring far too easily. The crowd are loving it, and England have got to find a way to fight back in the second session of the day. Ben Stokes did not look a happy skipper as he walked into the dressing rooms leading his side off.
Keep smiling, Henry. We'll be back with you in an hour's time. And coverage continues, of course, Test Match Special, BBC Sounds. Back home, just a few lines. Man United's plans to go fifth in the Premier League thwarted last night by West Ham, who scored a late goal to earn a 1-1 draw at Old Trafford. Later today, the draw for next year's World Cup, the biggest and undoubtedly the most complicated, takes place in Washington, D.C. 48 teams drawn in 12 groups of four. England in pot one, Scotland in pot three, Wales and the Republic of Ireland among those in the playoff pots. Coverage across the BBC from 5 o'clock this afternoon. And Formula One's championship finale gets underway with first practice for Sunday's Grand Prix in Abu Dhabi starting in 3 hours' time. Remember, Britain's Lando Norris leads Max Verstappen by 12 points and Norris's McLaren teammate Oscar Piastri a further 4 points behind.
Oh, it's tense, isn't it? Jonathan, thank you.
This winter, cricket's oldest rivalry is reignited.
Bowl him! Bowl him first ball!
England and Australia do battle to compete for the Ashes.
That is extraordinary.
Hear live ball-by-ball commentary on 5 Sports Extra and get analysis and reaction of every day's play with the Test Match Special podcast.
The stump's out of the ground.
Test Match Special at the Ashes. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Time now is 6:30. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Amol Rajan. Here's a summary of the news from Alan Smith.
The Eurovision Song Contest has been thrown into disarray after 4 countries said they wouldn't take part in next year's event in protest against Israel's inclusion. Ireland, Spain, the Netherlands and Slovenia had wanted Israel to be removed because of the war in Gaza. The European Broadcasting Union says Israel can continue competing. The government will launch its child poverty strategy this morning, where it'll say it aims to lift more than 500,000 children out of poverty by 2030. The plan will include more help with upfront childcare costs, and families won't be housed in B&Bs for longer than 6 weeks. One of Britain's leading scientists says the UK's scientific future is being put at risk by the government's immigration system. The Nobel Prize winner Professor Sir Paul Nurse says visa fees, strict financial tests and NHS surcharges are deterring early career researchers who could instead choose to live in the US or Asia. Supporters of the current system say the charges help fund the NHS and address migration concerns. The Home Office says 60 delivery riders will be deported after being found working illegally in the UK. They were detained during 7 days of immigration action across the country last month, which saw more than 170 arrests. President Putin is holding talks about trade and defence with India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi today. Moscow and Delhi are expected to sign a number of deals, despite pressure from the US for India to cut back its ties with Russia. The US military says it's conducted another strike on a boat suspected of carrying illegal drugs, this time in the Eastern Pacific. 4 people have been killed. Members of Congress have been briefed on the operations after they raised questions about their legality. And allegations of poor animal welfare standards and biosecurity have led to a premium turkey breeder being suspended from the Red Tractor Food Standards Scheme. Hock and Hurl Turkeys in Lincolnshire provides birds to UK farms. The firm says it's investigating.
Thank you, Alan. As you were just hearing there, then Ireland, Spain, Denmark, Slovenia all boycotting next year's Eurovision Song Contest after the organisers decided that Israel would still be able to take part in the competition. David Sillitoe is our media and arts correspondent. David, morning. We know the result of this, but what was the process?
This was actually a series of concerns that arose after this year's contest. The basic one: a number of countries, especially Netherlands, Spain, Ireland, Slovenia, were concerned about Israel's participation in the contest because, of course, of the country's actions in Gaza. But there was also another element to it, which was the success of Israel this year. if you remember the contest, if you're up late at night, you'll remember how they were far down the leaderboard until that public vote came in and suddenly went to the top and almost won the contest. They got a huge public vote, and there was a concern, was there an organised PR campaign behind that in some way? And some countries were sort of worried that in some way this was, the contest was being used sort of as a political platform. So the actual thing that was voted on yesterday in Geneva was about changes to the rules. It was about changes trying to stop any third-party PR campaign and also reducing the number of public votes from 20 per person down to 10 per person. Because they voted for that, the change in rules, they didn't then do a vote about expelling Israel. So essentially, they've changed the rules, and it meant that Israel will perform next year in Austria.
And of course, the great contradiction at the heart of Eurovision, David, is the fact that they say it's not about politics, it's about music bringing people together, but actually it's absolutely steeped in politics, really.
The whole point of the Eurovision Song Contest when it was created was essentially to bring Europe together, to unite it. And you've got to remember what that slogan is, United by Music. It has always had a sense of soft politics underneath it, about bringing people together and having a politics-free space. If you ever manage to do that, that's a hope. It's very rarely a reality. But it has not had anything like this in the past. We have got these four countries. There are two other countries, Iceland and Belgium, who've expressed concern. They'll be making a decision in the days to come. And the final decision will have to be made by next Wednesday as to who will take part. But you've got to look, though, at the wider aspects to all of this. There were 37 countries taking part last year. So even if you had six boycotting it, it would still be a packed contest. It would still be going on into the early hours of the morning. But it is certainly... that slogan, United by Music, it's looking a bit shaky at the moment.
David, thank you. David Sillitoe there.
25 to 7, the front page of the Financial Times this morning has a very striking picture of President Putin and Narendra Modi, the Indian leader, in the back of a taxi together. The headline is Side by Side, India Renews Ties to Russia. The two leaders are due to host a press conference together starting about 20 past 8 our time. We're going to be speaking to a very senior Indian diplomat and also Steve Rosenberg at the time. Let's speak to Arunodoy Mukherjee, who is following events very closely for us. Arunodoy, what's the sort of tone of this meeting been? Because it's an annual summit, isn't it? But there does seem to be a particular warmth to this year's gathering.
And I think that was illustrated the most last evening when we saw Prime Minister Narendra Modi, in a rare gesture, arrive at the airport and personally welcome Russian President Vladimir Putin. As he alighted from his aircraft, he was met with Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who hugged him, gave him a handshake, and both of them started walking together, and they sat in Prime Minister Narendra Modi's car and they drove off together. It was reminiscent of what we've seen Prime Minister Modi do in Vladimir Putin's limo way back in September this year at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit in China. So already within minutes of him arriving, I think the tone was set, and I think it was a message to the West from both leaders. Vladimir Putin's message that I still have friends despite everything that is going on. Prime Minister Modi's message was that Delhi's relationship with Moscow is not going to be dictated by any kind of pressure from the US, and I think it's in that atmosphere that these conversations will happen. But having said that, obviously it is still going to be a tightrope walk, so behind all the photo ops and the smiles, there is going to be some walking, a balancing act on part of Prime Minister Narendra Modi as he figures out how to ensure he stays close to Russia but also doesn't jeopardize his relations with the West.
And Arunodoy, does India take a view on whether Russia's actions in Ukraine are illegal, unjustified or immoral?
I think India has been very clear from the beginning. India has said that the only way out of that conflict is through peace, is through dialogue. That's the only way to resolve that conflict. But it has not gone beyond that by openly, sort of very vocally or aggressively criticizing Russia.
Right.
And I think that's making Delhi's stand very clear. And also in the way in which they have defense cooperation, or even the fact that they continue to buy Russian crude oil, that also illustrates the relationship.
Arunodoy Mukherjee for the BBC. Thank you very much indeed.
It's 22 minutes to seven. There are reports that workers could be awarded unlimited compensation for unfair dismissal as part of the government's employment rights reforms, which have been extensively discussed both in Parliament and on this programme as well. Harry Farley, our political correspondent, joins us. Morning, Harry.
Morning.
So what is the latest on this?
Yes, well, if you remember, it was just over a week ago the government announced it would U-turn on that original promise to bring in protections for workers against unfair dismissal from day one of their employment. That will now happen after 6 months. But this is all part of a sort of compromise agreement that's been reached with the unions, and the government's now expected to abolish the current limits on compensation that employees can get in those unfair dismissal cases. There is currently a cap of whichever is lower, between one year's salary or around £118,000. And the other compromise is the protections will come in earlier than some had thought. The hope in government is that this can clear the way for this really quite significant piece of legislation, which, as you say, has been stuck in the House of Lords for some months, repeatedly opposed by peers. The hope in government is this will clear the way for it to pass into law quite quickly. Although I have to say, some of the reaction from business leaders to that compromise on the compensation, on lifting sort of the cap on compensation, some of the reactions suggest that might not be as straightforward as ministers hope.
And the name Angela Rayner making an appearance this morning.
I think this is the other element of this, which is noteworthy. The role of Angela Rayner, of course, former Deputy Prime Minister, and really, I suppose, the original champion of these workers' rights reforms. After that original U-turn last week, many Labour MPs were concerned, and I'm told that she has been making her feelings known to ministers. She threatened to table an amendment to the bill to bring in those new unfair dismissal protections in more quickly. The government has now agreed to that, and a Labour source close to Angela Rayner said that she would easily have had the numbers, but it won't need to come to that now. A sign, perhaps, that Angela Rayner is more willing to mobilise the support, the considerable support that she has on Labour's backbenchers.
Harry Farley, thank you.
20 to 7, let's take you through some of the other stories that are emerging in the papers. A couple of really interesting business stories around. One, the FT covers. It follows I think it's a scoop by Bloomberg, but Meta, Mark Zuckerberg's company, formerly known as Facebook, has significantly scaled back its investment on a thing that gave it reason to rename itself Meta, which is the metaverse. The metaverse is this kind of 3D realm where avatar kind of representations of ourselves do things like buy things and interact with each other. But it looks like Meta has significantly scaled back its investment in the metaverse to focus much more on AI. It suggests that basically the plans for potential layoffs might change, and shares at Meta rose as much as 7% on opening in New York before tumbling to gains of 4%, adding around $60 billion to the company's market value. So investors like the idea of scaling back on the metaverse to focus more on AI. And meanwhile, yeah, we covered it a bit in business about 25 minutes ago, but it's just a really interesting media story developing where Warner Brothers Discovery is said to be in exclusive talks with Netflix. Fliss Hannah covered this in the business news. It's worth keeping an eye on this over the course of today, because it does suggest that a new strategic move by Netflix, obviously these are just talks, it hasn't yet happened, but if Netflix is going to get into the business of acquiring these enormous studios, that is a fundamental shift for the streaming service at a time when it's also moving into podcasts as well. Worth keeping an eye on that. I'm sure we'll come back to that next week.
Yeah, I'm sure we will. Daily Express this morning talks about flu, fears of the worst flu wave to strike the NHS this winter. The cases are at a record high at the moment for this time of year, partly due to the fact that when they decided much earlier on in the year, and that's sort of about the spring, when they decide which strain they're going to base the vaccines on, there is another one that has come out and become dominant since then. The message is still get your flu jab, get your vaccine, but it's clearly going to really take a toll on the NHS in the next few weeks and months. Also interesting story in the front of the Times this morning. This is something that Martin Lewis was talking about on the programme on the day that the new energy cap was confirmed. And the Times has carried out analysis on our energy bills. It says Rachel Reeves has pledged to cut energy bills by £150 a year, will be largely wiped out by the new levies on gas and electricity prices from the regulator. Things like expanding Britain's power grid, maintaining the gas pipelines, the Sizewell C nuclear power plant, all of those infrastructure projects will be added onto the bill in small amounts. And the Times says that could add up enough to cancel out the savings.
It is 17 minutes to seven. Let's tell you about yesterday in Parliament, because MPs have questioned whether the UK is as safe as it can be from Russian agents. Their concern came after the inquiry into the Salisbury
mercury poisonings in 2018, found that President Putin was, quote, morally responsible for the death of Dawn Sturgis. She died after coming into contact with the Novichok nerve agent used in the attempted assassination of the Russian former double agent Sergei Skripal. Here's our parliamentary correspondent, Susan Hume.
Russia has always denied having anything to do with the Novichok attack in Salisbury 7 years ago, but somehow the main findings of the inquiry don't seem all that surprising.
The chair concludes that the operation must have been signed off at the highest level of the Russian state, including President Putin.
That was the security minister, Dan Jarvis.
Those who were involved in the assassination attempt against Sergei Skripal were morally responsible for Dawn's death, and that deploying a highly toxic nerve agent in a busy city was an astonishingly reckless act.
Dan Jarvis went on to describe how Russia was still up to no good in the UK, and he detailed the government's response, involving sweeping new sanctions against the Russian intelligence service, the GRU, expulsions and the unmasking of spies. The Conservative opposition spokesperson, Chris Philp, usually takes the opposition bit of his title very seriously, but not this time.
I think I agree with and support everything the security minister said.
He said Russia's malign activity around the world meant the West must be steadfast in supporting Ukraine. And he had a warning against giving Moscow too much in a peace deal.
Appeasement doesn't work. Showing weakness when faced with an aggressive dictator simply emboldens them. And I hope those people in our government and other governments, particularly the American administration, keep that in mind as they conduct negotiations in the coming days and weeks.
But speaking for the Lib Dems, Will Forster was concerned that a valuable Russian double agent had been resettled in the UK simply as Mr. Skripal. Perfectly easy for a couple of Russian assassins to look him up.
Sergei was a clear target from Russian state assassins. The inquiry states that he was resettled in the UK under his own name. Russia used this to track him down and MI5 failed to rename him. Can the minister confirm to the House why the security services left him in an alarmingly accessible situation?
He asked, why didn't Sergei Skripal at least have CCTV, alarms, secure accommodation? Dan Jarvis said he took seriously his responsibility to hold the security services to account, but he argued, don't blame them.
The use of a military-grade nerve agent on British soil was a violation of international law and a truly despicable act. And the responsibility for that lies with Russia and Russia alone.
The MP for Salisbury, the Conservative John Glenn, was concerned that a few politicians here had some admiration for President Putin, and he singled out his reform opponent at last year's general election.
Putin is a ruthless dictator, not someone deals can be done with. And contrary to one of the candidates in the general election last year in Salisbury who said, I admire him as a political operator, I do not.
Some MPs, including the minister, referred to the former MEP and leader of Reform UK in Wales, Nathan Gill, who's just been jailed for admitting to taking bribes to make pro-Russian speeches and interviews. The Reform MP, Danny Kruger, had no truck with that.
It's absolutely right we do everything we can to resist Russia's attacks on our security and its attempts to suborn our democracy, and I wholeheartedly agree with him, and it's obviously absolutely right that the traitorous former MEP that the minister mentioned is now in prison.
Now, the minister spent a lot of time elaborately praising MPs' insight and knowledge on the issue and denouncing President Putin, but he didn't actually give them many new facts in his answers. For example, a Conservative, Sir Julian Lewis, wanted to know if Sergei Skripal, who'd been pardoned and exchanged, was a retired spy or not.
Was Skripal engaged in anything that made him a target?
Dan Jarvis was careful.
I can say to him that I have formed a view about the motive that underpins this particular attack, but I'm not going to get into it today.
Then another Conservative, Sarah Bull, picked up on reports that two suspected Russian spies had slipped into the UK aboard cargo ships and then visited areas close to military bases.
What steps are you taking to secure UK commercial ports, given reports more recently of individuals with links to the Russian military entering via these routes?
Once again, Dan Jarvis hinted, but wouldn't say.
I think it's an entirely reasonable point that the Honourable Lady has made. I think she will understand that I won't want to get too much into the detail of that.
Sarah Bull nodded sympathetically at that, not really an answer. And if anyone is investigating the source of all the government leaks and spicy briefings going on recently, Dan Jarvis is probably not even on their suspect list.
That was Susan Hume reporting on Yesterday in Parliament. The time now is 12 minutes to 7 and Australia is still 131 for 1.
I'm impressed by your multitasking. You've got one BDI.
You've been watching the cricket.
On that. Yeah, let's see if we get to 9 o'clock. Now, a BBC investigation has uncovered evidence that hundreds of people were subjected to electric shock therapy aimed to change their sexuality in NHS hospitals during the 1960s and 70s. The BBC's Hayley Hassel has led this investigation. Just to warn you as well, you might find some of what she describes distressing.
Aversion therapy was a painful type of procedure where patients had electric straps fastened to their arms and legs and they were given electric shocks, often for more than an hour at a time every week over about a 12-month period, to try and change their sexuality. The idea was to associate the pain with their sexual preferences. Now, for this documentary, I've been meeting with survivors who've told me that they went through this awful treatment, and I've been trying to uncover the full extent of what and where this treatment happened. What I've uncovered is that I know it occurred in more than 10 NHS hospitals to at least 250 people between 1963 and 1973. Most of this happened after homosexuality was partially decriminalised, but it also happened to lesbian women and trans people and children. The patients were often bribed or coerced with threats like being expelled from school or losing their job. One of the first people I spoke to was Jeremy, who was at a school in Bradford when he told his teacher he was gay. His teacher and his head teacher told him he'd be expelled unless he had the treatment. And then they took him to a local psychiatric hospital when he was stripped naked, strapped to a chair and made to have painful electric shocks lasting about an hour every week for 6 months. During one session, he actually passed out and woke up in hospital 3 days later. Jeremy, after that, was unable to focus on his studies and he was unable to complete his exams. So it's left him with a life of pain, but also without an education and severe depression. Now, Jeremy's story wasn't unique. As I continued my investigation, I discovered that one of the largest trials ever carried out happened at Crumpsall Hospital in Manchester, where at least 73 people were subjected to these so-called treatments. One of them was Pauline. She was 19 and studying psychology when doctors told her that they could change her sexuality. She was given about 20 sessions, which left her in pain, but also in a fragile state. And months later, she was admitted to a psychiatric ward with responsive depression. This is how she remembers her treatment.
Deep inside was this awful secret. And I knew it was something that was shameful. I knew it was something that I shouldn't talk about. And it was making me very miserable. When I went for this first appointment, I was shown up to the treatment room, which was in semi-darkness. And there was a young man there, a trainee psychologist. And in front of it was a big screen. He taped electrodes to my arms and gave me a series of shocks. They made me sweat. You could either get the electric shock immediately the photograph came up, or you could get it after 30 seconds.
The Crumpsall trials in Manchester were overseen by academics at Manchester University, and they have contacted us to express regret, saying that the attitudes behind the experiment were widely held at the time and they're now considered unethical and harmful. The university has offered its sorrow for being part of that environment. Also, Lord Chris Smith, who's the UK's first openly gay cabinet minister, has called for a formal apology from both the government and the NHS, describing the treatment as quite simply inhumane. And in response to our findings, we sent our results to the government. And as a result of that investigation, the BBC understands that the government will now investigate the historic use of electric shock therapy in the NHS.
That was Hayley Hassel. It is now 7:08. Let's turn to Tunbridge Wells, because in Tunbridge Wells, around 24,000 properties were affected by a lack of water this week. That's both residential properties and businesses, and the effects are still being felt. South East Water is still asking all those affected to boil water before drinking it, or washing dishes, or preparing food, or brushing teeth. And that, of course, has financial implications because of energy costs. What should be done? Well, we have asked for an interview with the chief executive of South East Water, that's David Hinton, but have been deferred to other representatives, who indeed we spoke to earlier in the week. But naturally, we're keen on this programme to speak to the boss. So if Mr. Hinton can spare the time, our invitation remains open. Mike Martin is the Liberal Democrat MP for Tunbridge Wells and joins us now. Mr. Martin, good morning.
Good morning, Amal.
Thanks so much for joining us. Just before we get to your letter to the Water Minister, what should happen now? Can you just give us a sense of what happened this week and why?
Sure. So on Saturday, a number of houses started to lose water in Tunbridge Wells. And then overnight, Saturday, Sunday, so last weekend, almost all the houses in Tunbridge Wells lost water. And the crisis management in terms of setting up bottled water stations was non-existent. So the borough council and myself were having to direct South East Water where to put them. And then we've had a successive series of announcements that the water would be coming back on Sunday, then on Monday, then on Tuesday. And this was referenced by the Prime Minister at PMQs on Wednesday when the water was still not back on. And eventually now the water has come back on. I mean, mine came on back on yesterday evening. But as you said in your intro, you have to boil it if you want to use it for drinking or teeth washing or anything like that.
It's a total nightmare for some of your constituents, including some of the businesses.
Absolutely. I mean, with this week, we've been focusing on GPs, care homes, trying to get the schools back up. And I think we're getting there with that. But actually, if you run a restaurant or a hotel, you've lost tens of thousands of pounds this week. I mean, the Royal Tunbridge Wells Hotel has basically shut it up and said they've lost 30 grand this week.
Have you had the pleasure to speak to Mr. Hinton of South East Water?
Well, I mean, I called for him to resign fairly on in this crisis. And then we had one further phone call after that where he ranted and raved at me. I mean, it was an extraordinary phone call.
Tell us about it. What happened?
Well, I was actually putting my kids to bed and I had five missed calls from him in quick succession. And then he effectively said I didn't know what I was doing. I was grandstanding. I didn't understand the water industry. And then there was some sort of really personal stuff about, you know, how could I possibly sleep at night calling for his resignation? I mean, it was absolutely extraordinary.
Why was he launching that attack on you?
Because I called for him to resign. And the reason I've called for him to resign is because we had this exact issue in 2022 in Tunbridge Wells. The water went off for 6 days just before Christmas. It's almost an identical issue. And we were promised that by him, in public and personally to me, that the resilience of the network would be sorted out, that the crisis management would be sorted out and the communications would be sorted out. And none of that turned out to be true.
Well, look, we believe in fairness on this programme. So let me read you a brief statement from South East Water. They said, well, their incident manager, I should say, Mark Sims, said, "We are very sorry to all our customers in Tunbridge Wells who have been experiencing issues with their water supply. Our focus is entirely on returning supplies to our customers and the subsequent lifting of the boil water notice as soon as possible. Once we've returned supplies to all customers and lifted the boil water notice, a thorough investigation will take place into what happened." I just repeat that Mr. Hinton is very welcome to come on this programme and answer for himself what has happened. We kind of also believe in accountability, so I'd like to reissue that invitation. You've written, Mr. Martin, to the Water Minister. What's the ask?
Yeah, the ask is that now we need to move for our businesses into a continuity and recovery phase, because many of these are going to go under. In 2022, we had several businesses go under because of South East Water's outage. I've asked for £18.5 million from central government in a kind of COVID-style scheme where we can issue grants immediately to local businesses. This is a critical period for businesses before Christmas. If you don't make money now, if you're not open, then there's a good chance you'll go under in the new year.
Okay, Mike Martin, MP for Tunbridge Wells, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Look forward to continuing that discussion if we get the chance to speak to the boss of South East Water. It is 7:03. Anna is just recording another interview elsewhere. So while she's away, let's tell you how you can hear more of her tomorrow night.
From our own correspondent at 70.
All that evening, Baghdad had been shaking.
I remember recognising Chairman Mao's brilliant...
In charge of this Aladdin's cave is a babushka.
I'm Anna Foster, and to celebrate 7 decades of global reporting, I'll be talking to some familiar foreign correspondents.
And the soldier says, "No, no, 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 no press." And Jeremy says, "BBC." And the soldier looks at him and goes, "Lise Doucette?"
Including Lise Doucette, Jeremy Bowen, Steve Rosenberg and Kate Ady.
Wow, what a fook I could write.
From our own correspondent at 70 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Tomorrow night at 8.
As if by magic, Anna has just walked into the studio and sat down. It's amazing how this technology works. It's 2 minutes to seven. Let's have the weather with Helen Willits.
Amal, thanks. Hello there. Good morning. Low pressure is bearing down upon us again today. And it's going to be bring some fairly strong winds with it, strong to gale force winds indeed. So let's start the detail across southeast England, the Midlands, East Anglia and the northeast of England, where actually it's quite quiet. Temperatures are below freezing. So ice and fog. There's some patchy fog, particularly in the southeast, where there's a warning from the Met Office. Visibility is below 100 metres. And believe me, I've driven through it this morning and it was pretty nasty. So that's all to contend with first thing this morning. But once that lifts, then it should be a fairly dry and bright day with some sunshine, although that'll turn hazy as the cloud piles in from the west later on. And still chilly, 6 or 7 degrees here. Now, for the rest of England, along with Wales, so southwest England, Wales and the northwest, we've got a few showers already ahead of the rain, and temperatures are actually below freezing here in a few spots, so could be a little bit icy, but the rain's coming in now to Cornwall. It's knocking on the door of Pembrokeshire, and it will push its way across all parts through the day. Some quite heavy rain, and as I mentioned already, strong to gale force winds, particularly around the coasts. Temperatures up to 11 degrees, though, in places. Northern Ireland now have the rain creeping into the west, so it will be cloudy and it will turn increasingly wet for all parts through the morning and stay for the afternoon. Windy too at 9 to 11. For Scotland, the rain in the east will clear. Then it's bright with a scattering of showers here, but the rain's coming into the south and west later on those gale force winds, highs between 5 and 9.
Thank you, Helen. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Amal Rajan and Anna Foster.
It's 7 o'clock on Friday the 5th of December. The headlines this morning. A rift over Israel's participation is threatening to tear apart the Eurovision Song Contest after four countries pulled out, including the Netherlands.
With me there are several other countries, and yes, that has everything to do with what we stand for, our values. And then I can't make any other decision.
That was the Director General of the Dutch broadcaster Avrotros talking to journalists. The government is setting out its plans to cut child poverty by addressing housing problems and childcare costs. We'll hear from the Homelessness Minister. And one of Britain's leading scientists has warned that the UK is shooting itself in the foot with its visa system for overseas researchers. Professor Sir Paul Nurse will join us before 8 o'clock.
Also coming up in the next hour of the programme, the boss of Waterstones on what the budget means for bookstores and...
Big... Friendly Giant.
BFG for short.
We will hear how the Roald Dahl favourite, the BFG, is going from the screen, well, from the book, I suppose, to the screen, and now to the stage with the RSC. The BBC News is read for us this morning by Alan Smith.
The Eurovision Song Contest has been thrown into turmoil after four countries said they would boycott next year's event. Ireland, Spain, the Netherlands and Slovenia had wanted Israel to be excluded because of the war in Gaza. But a meeting of the European Broadcasting Union said the country could take part. The managing director of Eurovision said the contest had to keep a sense of neutrality, but more countries could still pull out. Here's our music correspondent Mark Savage.
This is the biggest crisis in Eurovision's 70-year history, with little sign that the differences over Israel's role can be resolved. Germany welcomed the decision not to disqualify the country, and the BBC said it supported the collective decision of Eurovision's member states. But there is still a possibility that more countries could pull out, including Belgium and Iceland. The Spanish broadcaster, RTVE, has been particularly outspoken about how the row has been handled, saying it has lost faith in Eurovision's organisers. The chair of Slovenia's national broadcaster said the precedent set when Russia was excluded should be continued, arguing that no aggressor should take part. In response, Israel accused critics of trying to silence it. The former Eurovision winner, Dana International, said the decision of four countries to boycott was violent and insulting and added to hatred. With such deep divisions, it's hard to envisage a path to reconciliation for the Eurovision family.
The government has promised to lift around 550,000 children out of poverty by 2030 in its child poverty strategy. There will be more help with upfront childcare costs for families on universal credit and measures to reduce stays in bed and breakfast accommodation. Housing charities say the improvements are just a sticking plaster, but children's charities have broadly welcomed the strategy. Our reporter Vanessa Clark has more.
Across the UK, 4.5 million children are living in poverty. That's one in three children, mostly in working families. Key changes in the child poverty strategy already announced include scrapping the two-child benefit cap from April next year and extending free school meals to all families on universal credit. Measures such as extending help with upfront childcare costs and extra funding for councils to improve temporary accommodation are expected to affect much smaller groups of people, according to the think tank, the Institute for Fiscal Studies. The most recent figures showed there were, at the end of June, just over 2,000 households with children in England who'd been in B&B accommodation for more than the legal limit of 6 weeks. The government has confirmed that it'll extend a pilot programme to try to end this across 20 local authorities.
The US military says it's conducted another strike on a boat suspected of carrying illegal drugs, this time in the Eastern Pacific, killing four people. Earlier, armed forces commanders briefed members of Congress on a double strike on a boat in September after questions were raised about whether such attacks were legal. Our North America correspondent Peter Bowes reports.
In a statement on the social media platform X, the US military said the latest attack occurred after intelligence confirmed that the vessel was carrying illegal narcotics along a known narco-trafficking route. Alongside video of the attack, the statement says the strike was carried out at the direction of the US Defense Secretary, Pete Hegseth. Earlier, lawmakers were shown video of a September attack involving two strikes on a boat that killed two stranded sailors. The Democratic Senator Jack Reed said he was deeply disturbed by what he'd seen and called for the video to be released to the public.
President Putin of Russia is holding talks in Delhi with India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi, which are expected to focus on trade and defence spending. The two countries are expected to sign a number of deals despite US pressure on Delhi to scale back its links to Moscow. One of Britain's most distinguished scientists, the Nobel Prize winner, Professor Sir Paul Nurse, says the government's visa system is putting the UK's scientific future at risk. Sir Paul, who's taken over as the president of the Royal Society, says fees, strict financial tests and NHS surcharges are deterring early career researchers who could instead choose to live in the US, Asia or mainland Europe. He spoke to our science correspondent, Palab Ghosh.
Sir Paul warns that countries such as China and Singapore are pouring money into research and actively courting overseas scientific talent. The Nobel Prize winner describes the UK's science base as fragile, undermined by a combination of steep visa costs, funding pressures, and the negative signal current immigration rules send to early career researchers from abroad. And he urges ministers to rethink a system that forces scientists to pay an annual NHS surcharge and to prove they have thousands of pounds in the bank before they arrive. He says it makes zero sense to put hurdles in front of the very people who drive innovation and growth. Supporters of the current system say higher visa costs and the health surcharge help to fund the NHS and reflect wider public concerns about migration levels.
The Home Office says 60 delivery riders will be deported after being found to be working illegally in the UK. They were detained during 7 days of immigration enforcement action across the country last month. Simon Jones reports.
The government has recognised that the apparent ease with which people who have no right to work in the UK can get a job acts as a significant pull factor for migrants. The Home Office has carried out what it's described as a national enforcement blitz, in which 171 delivery riders were arrested in the space of 7 days. 60 of them have been detained for removal from the UK. The Border Security Minister, Alex Norris, has also met representatives from the food delivery firms to encourage them to do more to tackle the issue, such as using facial recognition checks to prevent illicit account sharing.
The Crown Prosecution Service says men in England and Wales are under-reporting instances of domestic abuse. Data seen exclusively by BBC News shows men were victims in 1 in 6 cases where domestic abuse led to charges. The CPS is providing new training for prosecutors to reflect this. Graham Ritchie from the CPS says often men don't come forward.
they believe that their experience is unique, that it's not happened to other men, because we don't really talk about this in society. So they don't see other male victims who've experienced something similar to them in the news or in general media. So they feel alone.
And your report by the government spending watchdog says many frail older people in England are not having the regular health checks that could keep them out of hospital for longer. The National Audit Office found that there was a worrying variation in how people were supported in different parts of the country. Here's our social affairs editor, Alison Holt.
There are at least 1.5 million people over the age of 65 in England who are considered moderately or severely frail. It means as they've aged, they've developed a range of health conditions, lost fitness, and are often housebound. They are nearly six times more likely than others to be admitted to hospital. GPs are required to identify frail older people among their patients. But the NAO report says only one in six patients over 65 is being assessed. Even if they are checked, very few get the medication reviews and falls assessments that should follow. The report says there needs to be a greater focus on supporting this group to improve their health and take pressure off the NHS. The government says it's working at pace to ensure better support.
And in the cricket, Australia are making steady progress in their first innings on day two of the second Ashes test against England in Brisbane. A short time ago, they were 142 for one. They're replying to England's first innings total of 334.
And in fact, Alan, they've just lost a wicket. Geoffrey Archer's got Jake Weatherall, so they won 46 for two. Thank you very much indeed, Alan. It's 9 minutes past seven. Let's return to that lead story this morning about Eurovision, because Ireland, Spain, the Netherlands and Slovenia are boycotting next year's Eurovision Song Contest in protest at Israel's participation. They announced their decision after the European Broadcasting Union, the EBU, decided not to hold a vote on whether Israel should be excluded over its military action in Gaza. Martin Green is director of the Eurovision Song Contest.
What I'm pleased is the membership have had a full opportunity to debate it, and I can tell you it was a full, frank, honest and quite moving debate. But as we can see from the emphatic result, what they really came together on is a belief that Eurovision Song Contest shouldn't be used as a political theatre.
Natalia Gorščak, the chair of the board of RTV, Slovenia's national public broadcaster, spoke to our colleagues on The World Tonight.
Our audience asked us to pull out. We already last year, we received so many demands, you know, to get out of the Eurovision because of the attacks of Israel to Gaza. And also our performers wanted us to get out. So in the name of Slovenian public, we are doing that.
Well, let's speak to Dr. Dean Vuletic, academic historian of contemporary Europe, author of Postwar Europe and the Eurovision Song Contest. Dr. Vuletic, good morning.
Good morning, Amal.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us. Eurovision is 70 next year. Has it ever seen a boycott or indeed controversy like this?
It has seen several boycotts, but usually they've been bilateral. The biggest boycott was actually in 1970 when five countries boycotted, but that was over the voting system and criticisms of the quality of the contest. They weren't motivated by any political reasons. So next year we'll actually see the biggest boycott of Eurovision for a political reason.
Do you expect others to join?
I do, actually. I mean, the next couple of weeks are going to be tense as countries confirm whether or not they're going to participate in Eurovision next year. But I think that we will see more boycotts because public opinion in several of the participating countries is in favour of a boycott.
What is this actually about? Because presumably it's largely about the sort of the consequences on the ground of the war in Gaza, but to some degree, is it also about other adjacent issues such as the freedom of the media?
Absolutely. The war in Gaza is the first issue. The second issue is the freedom of the media. The broadcasters that are boycotting are criticising Israel for not allowing journalists to access Gaza. They also criticize the Israeli public service broadcaster for its way of reporting on the war in Gaza. And then the third issue is actually the contest itself. There is a sense of betrayal that the Israeli broadcaster last year and the year before submitted an entry which did reference the October 7 attacks, so which was perceived as politicizing the contest. And of course, there's a lot of criticism of the fact that the Israeli government was involved last year and this year in promotional campaigns to garner votes for the Israeli entry.
To what extent, Dr. Vuletic, has Eurovision always been a form of politics by other means?
It has always been political. I mean, I always go back to the first contest in 1956, the prime example being West Germany, which then sent a Jew and a Holocaust survivor to represent it. So that was already a strong message in the very first edition of Eurovision. And since then, we've seen countries using Eurovision as a stage to send political messages, to brand themselves as well. But it's really in the last 10 years that Eurovision has become embroiled in political controversies attached to broader political and social movements, particularly the pro-Palestinian one, but also ones related to the war in Ukraine and ones concerning minority rights.
Dr. Dean Vuletic, author of Postwar Europe and the Eurovision Song Contest. Thank you very much indeed for joining us.
It's 13 minutes past seven. The government says families with children will no longer be housed in bed and breakfast accommodation for longer than the legal limit of 6 weeks. The most recent figures show more than 2,000 households were staying there beyond that time. It's one of the elements of Labour's child poverty strategy, but housing charities don't think that what's being announced today represents a permanent answer to the problem. Well, Alison McGovern is the Minister for Local Government and Homelessness, and I asked her practically how the government would make it work.
It's actually already unlawful to put families in B&B accommodation for more than 6 weeks. But it's quite a shocking fact, I think, that there are just over 2,000 families in that situation. And overall, just under 3,500 families in B&B. And this is no good for all the reasons that are completely obvious. Children haven't got space to play. Families might not have access to their own kitchen or bathroom or whatever. We've got to bring this to an end. So as part of the child poverty strategy today, we're announcing an extra £8 million emergency accommodation reduction pilots for the worst hit areas. Because this use of B&B accommodation really clusters in a few areas that have got the most acute housing crises. But what we know is that because some places have taken steps to acquire better temporary accommodation and to reduce the use of B&B, we know it can be done. Local councils have been massively underfunded over the past 15 years. So we need to make sure they've got the resources to do the job and then to help them get the better accommodation.
I was just going to ask, as part of this is funding for new, well, is it new homes? It says up to 5,000 high quality homes for better temporary accommodation. Are they new houses, which we know it's really difficult to build that slow? Are they repurposed homes? Who will own them? How will that bit work?
They can be either. So local authorities, because they've been so cash strapped, are paying for the most expensive temporary accommodation. So because their contracts are too short term, they end up paying for accommodation on nightly rates. That's a really bad way of spending the resources that we've got. But because they've been living hand to mouth, basically, local authorities, that's what they're forced into doing. So we've got both better council funding coming forward and also this extra fund, £950 million for local authorities so that they can acquire, it can be existing homes or new homes that they can use for their own temporary accommodation. And we know in those places where they've got less B&B accommodation, that it's because local authorities have been able to get hold of reasonable properties that families can then be temporarily housed in. And that's a much better situation than this B&B use.
What about the issue of people being able to afford them? Because housing charities have welcomed this, but they have concerns. Well, they call it a sticking plaster solution because they have concerns about families being able to afford it. Crisis say only 2.7% of properties are now affordable for people who are relying on housing benefit, and they want housing benefit to be increased.
Well, I can understand that because we know that prices in the private rented sector have gone up and up. And that's part of the reason we introduced our Renters' Rights Act, to give tenants more power in the private rental market. But you'll know that as part of the wider child poverty strategy, our overall approach is to increase incomes and to try to reduce costs for families, particularly those at the lower end of incomes. That's why we've got rid of the two-child limit from April. That's why the minimum wage is going up. That's why we're making sure that everyone has the right to sick pay. And we're also doing things like changing the way that universal credit works, so that the childcare payments that are available through universal credit can actually help families into work and out of poverty.
Will those things happen quickly enough, though?
Well, on, for example, the fair repayment rate, which means that if families are in debt through the universal credit system, they pay back at a lower rate to make sure that the government isn't throwing people into debt. Some of these things are already underway. I think that many of the measures come in from April. We're also reducing costs for people, whether that's freezing train fares or making sure, as I said, that we can, over the long term, build the homes that we need to make housing really affordable. I think that this will make a difference. And you'll know that if you look at right across our child poverty strategy, all the measures together, it's forecast that they will take 550,000 children out of poverty by the end of the parliament. Big improvement on where we are today.
I wanted to ask you, while you're here, there's a story around this morning about your colleague and friend, Angela Rayner, who apparently has negotiated to speed up the implementation of unfair dismissal protection. That's obviously legislation that she was heavily involved with. It's now due to come into effect on January the 1st, 2027, so sooner than it would have done. Are you pleased that she is still having an impact on things, even though she's no longer Deputy Prime Minister?
Angela believes in working class people having decent rights at work. And I don't think it would be a surprise to anyone at all that she is making sure that that legislation goes ahead in a way that is effective. I mentioned just before the new right of 1 million people, mainly low paid women, to get sick pay. And I think that is credit to Angela, who championed many of those policies for many years, and in government brought them forward. And yeah, it's no surprise to anyone
that she's made that
standing up for working people. No.
Alison McGovern, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much.
7:20, the chief executive of Waterstone says reforms to business rates in the budget are likely to mean more prosperous high streets. Fliss is back with more with James Daunt, I believe.
Yes, James Daunt, who runs Waterstones, the American bookseller Barnes & Noble, and who also founded the smaller chain Daunt Books. We discussed the reform of business rates, which the Chancellor said would mean permanently lower tax rates for more than 750,000 retail, hospitality and leisure properties, paid for by a higher levy on larger buildings. There has been some criticism, particularly from people in hospitality, many of whom saw their rateable values increase last Wednesday. So I asked James Daunt what Rachel Reeves' budget meant for his business.
Well, I seem to be about the only person who is sympathetic to the situation that she's in. For myself, certainty is helpful, and perhaps a little less sort of dithering around and wondering whether they're going to do this, that or the other. But clearly taxes have to go up if all public spending has to come down, or a combination of both. And it seems we're heading, as always seen, most sensible to a combination of both. But we've, over the last couple of years, had a very nice time of it and have found most of what has been enacted, you know, reasonably sensible from our perspective. In the narrow sense as a retailer, there were changes particularly to the business rates, which impact shops, which was very helpful and something, incidentally, been calling on for decades, really, long, long overdue, where, you know, the taxation on high street shops has been disproportionate and very damaging, I think, to the importance of shops within communities. And now at last something is being done sort of more substantial than has been the case for many years.
So this was a change to business rates in the budget to essentially allow smaller shops to pay less, larger shops to pay more. Were you a winner or a loser then from that?
Well, we have both, and therefore we benefited on one side and not on the other. But what's important for us is to be able to keep shops in as many places as possible. And we've been very steadfast in that. We haven't closed our shops in many of the less affluent parts of the United Kingdom. But we need neighbours, and this will help our neighbours. And we want vigorous high streets. So we're very pleased with this.
So it won't make a change to sort of where you open stores, or will it change some of your larger stores? Will they potentially struggle as a result, or is it just all good news?
It's for us, I think it's all good news. It means that our shops in places that are struggling, where there's a lot of vacancies, and we have shops in, you know, all up and down the land, and we're opening, you know, a relatively modest number, maybe 10 a year otherwise. But our existing shops are more likely to have, you know, prosperous high streets with less vacancies. And that's a really good thing.
It is 23 minutes past seven now. Ofcom has told the BBC that it's never heard from a porn company which it fined £1 million for failing to comply with the Online Safety Act. It has been repeatedly emailing AVS Group, which hasn't replied at all. Oliver Griffiths, Ofcom's Online Safety Group director, was on the programme yesterday and was asked if they had received payment from any of the fines handed out.
Literally, I think this is the second or third fine that we have done. So, no, we haven't had a payment of a fine yet. But, you know, we have the ability to move through, if people don't pay fines, either to recover against them in court or to seek a court order for so-called business disruption measures. And that's where a site can be blocked completely from UK users.
Well, Zoe Kleiman is our technology editor. Morning, Zoe.
Good morning.
So this sort of took on an extra life, really, didn't it? Because it turns out that this company, which had done wrong and had been fined for it, they just can't seem to track them down at all.
Yeah, well, I was trying to track them down yesterday after the fine was announced, primarily because I just wanted to see what they had to say for themselves. And what I discovered was that they're registered to an address in Belize, which is an address that's used by lots of shell companies, it turns out. It's actually also been named in the Panama Papers. So I think it's very unlikely that there's any sort of physical presence there at all. Then we followed some other sort of digital breadcrumbs, which led us to a company called Tube Corporate, which says it's a publishing platform which publishes AVS Group sites. It runs 18 explicit sites, which are accessible obviously around the world, but also in the UK. And they have a very helpful little chat box in their window, in their website, and they say, we'll get back to you in under 5 minutes. Well, my chat has now been hanging for nearly 24 hours, Anna, so I don't think they're very keen to talk to me. There's an email address as well, which we emailed, and we didn't have a reply either. And I think what this shows really is how difficult this is for Ofcom, trying to, you know, to follow this process. So it is on a pathway now, as Oliver said. It's emailed the company. It's asked for information. It hasn't had a reply. It's issued a fine. It hasn't had a reply. It is now, I suppose, the next step will eventually be that it will be able to block these sites, perhaps inside the UK. But I guess that's a long process, you know, from flash to bang. I don't think that's going to happen overnight. It's very, very difficult, isn't it? You know where the big tech companies are, but it's very hard to get them to make changes. And fines don't really mean a lot to them because they've got so much money. And the little companies are very, very difficult to find, or they can be.
Yeah, so if we pull back, Zoe, from that excellent, by the way, detective work that you did yesterday, it leaves us sort of with this big hanging question, which is, can the Online Safety Act really have a proper impact at all if, as you say, the big companies who you can find, it's not that bothered about the fines because they've got plenty of money, and the small ones just do what they want because nobody can track them down?
Well, I mean, I think it certainly plays to the critics of the Online Safety Act and indeed Ofcom, who have said, you know, that it lacks teeth and that how exactly is it enforcing these rules if these companies that it's going after are, I mean, we don't even know if this company is actually aware that it's had the fine. You know, there's been zero acknowledgement or communication at all. I think, you know, I guess what it does mean, as I said, is that it can be blocked eventually, and perhaps that is what will happen. And that will be a first. That will be a real landmark for the Online Safety Act, that sites, you know, are no longer accessible in the UK because they are deemed to be too much of a risk to children, and the risk of them coming to harm, if you like, or stumbling upon this explicit material, the risk is too great. That has not happened in this country before. But it does show, doesn't it, that Ofcom really doesn't have an easy task here.
Zoe Kleiman, our technology editor, thank you.
27 minutes past seven. Atkinson's in, he bowls. Smith just turns it to leg and there's no run. 155 for two. Ball's doing a bit, but Australia on top. Jonathan.
Do you want to do Test Match Special commentary on Radio 4?
I think he probably does, Jonathan, okay. Yes.
You've basically said, it's not good news, is it, basically? I'm going to give you some good news first, if you're an England cricket fan. OK, let's get this straight. Joe Root finished with the highest score by a visiting player in a day-night test in Australia. He was 138 not out as England were dismissed for 334 in their first inning. Stop laughing, because Jofra Archer out for 38 in the highest 10th wicket stand by England in the first innings of an Ashes test in Australia since 1896. You knew that, didn't you, Al? Right. The bad news for England cricket fans is a tale of missed chances, wayward bowling and not enough Australian wickets, which is all very good if your name's Glenn McGrath and he's one of Australia's greatest fast bowlers and he joins us now. Good afternoon, Glenn.
Yeah, g'day, Jonathan.
155 for two. It's all going your way then, isn't it?
Things are going well for the Australians. They've just lost... Weatherall just recently, good delivery from Jofra Archer, but yeah, this pitch is playing nicely and Australians are looking to play positively. You know, before the break, last break, England didn't bowl as well as they could have, a little bit two lengths, and Australia dominated. So yeah, they're trying to fight back England, but Australia looking good at the moment.
What are they not getting right then? Because in the first innings in that first test in Perth, they were outstanding, the England bowlers. So what's not happening now in Brisbane?
Yeah, no, they were outstanding in Perth at first innings. Australia were a little bit negative as well. They were looking to survive rather than looking to put a bit of pressure back on the English bowlers. Since then, the second innings in Perth, they were positive. Here, the Australian batsmen have been positive again. So it's a bit of both, really. So, but this pitch here at the Gabba, they've taken more grass off than what's normal. Normal day-night pitch has about 8 millimetres of grass. They left 3 millimetres of grass, and I'm not sure why, whether they were hoping the game would continue longer than what we saw in Perth. So, yeah, it is hard work out there, especially when that ball gets a little bit softer. It's harder to really sort of, you know, put pressure on the batsman, blast wickets. You've got to bowl with discipline, and you've got to bowl with control. And that's what really England need to do now to build some pressure and get back in this game.
One other thought. This is a day-night match, as you say. So they're playing with a pink ball. What's the difference between playing with a pink ball and a red ball?
There's quite a significant difference, I reckon. They say the pink ball's closer to the white ball than what it is to the red ball. It's hard to pick up, a little bit harder to pick up, especially in twilight when it gets a little bit darker. The ball itself gets softer quicker than what the red ball does. There's a few different things there. There's a lot of different strategies. If you've got the new ball under lights, it's going to move around and be really tough to bat on. But if you've got an older ball, it doesn't seem to be quite as bad. So you've got to know when you're bowling, when you're batting, when you take the new ball. There's a lot of different strategies in this game, but the pink ball itself is closer to the white ball than the red one, so it gets softer quicker.
Okay, then. And what about the strategy, talking about strategy? How is Ben Stokes and his captaincy bearing up? Because one of the features of that second innings on the second day, when it all ended, was how England just seemed to implode when things went against them. How strong, how resilient are they showing at the moment?
Oh, they're hanging in there. They're still, they're still, 170, 180 runs shy Australia is, so there's still plenty of runs in the bank, and they've got to turn around and really take some wickets, put some pressure on Australia. I think the way England played in Perth in that second innings, especially with the bowling, they didn't really have the bowling plans. I thought weren't that good. They were waiting to hope for Australia to make a mistake. They bowled short, which wasn't the way to go on that Perth pitch. But to me, the significant difference between these two teams is the batting. England like to score quickly, but they take more risk when playing the shots, whereas Australia will make you bowl at them. So anything outside off stump on a good length, that they're leaving alone, whereas England want to go hard at those deliveries. And when you do that and play those deliveries, the risk factor goes up. And we saw in the first innings here, Harry Brook, Jamie Smith and a few others lost their wicket by doing that. So, they need to sort of learn from that, which balls to play at, which to leave. It's going to be hard work in this test match. I think that the pitch is really flattening out now once this ball gets a bit softer. But the one thing there may be cracks in this pitch. As the test match goes on, it's quite hot here, and you wonder whether they're going to come into play. So, yeah, there's still a lot of cricket left in this game at the moment. It's fairly evenly poised.
Glenn, thank you very much for your time. It's still 155 for two. Do we want a bit more commentary, Amol?
No,
you're
no,
good.
No,
love
it's
it.
Just too depressing,
just,
to be honest.
Just checking. Yep. Not if you're an Australian fan. And just to say, in an hour's time, we're going to be talking to a current England player. Jack Leach is going to be joining us. So there. So two twirlies in the studio.
Fantastic. Can't
wait. Look forward to that. Thank you, Jonathan. I am a little jealous, actually, looking at the beautiful sunshine dappling the pitch at the Gabba, because the weather here today is not offering much, really. Showers in the northeast of Scotland, mostly dry elsewhere this morning at least, but it'll turn windy with rain pushing in from the west in the afternoon.
Coming up at 10 to 8, we're speaking to Professor Sir Paul Nurse, the new president of the Royal Society. He's coming into the studio to talk about the future of science in the UK.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Amol Rajan and Anna Foster. It's 27 minutes to 8. Alan Smith has a summary of the news for us.
Four countries have said they will boycott next year's Eurovision Song Contest, throwing the event into disarray. Ireland, Spain, the Netherlands and Slovenia wanted Israel to be excluded because of the war in Gaza. A meeting of the European Broadcasting Union allowed Israel to continue competing, saying the contest had to retain its neutrality. The government is promising to lift around 550,000 children out of poverty by 2030 as it unveils its child poverty strategy later today. It says no children will have to grow up in bed and breakfast accommodation by limiting stays to a maximum of 6 weeks. Housing charities say the improvements are just a sticking plaster. The US military says four people have died in a strike on a boat suspected of carrying illegal drugs in the Eastern Pacific. Armed Forces commanders have briefed members of Congress about a double strike on a boat in September after questions were raised about the legality of such attacks. The Nobel Prize winner, Professor Sir Paul Nurse, says the UK's scientific future is being put at risk by the government's visa system. Sir Paul, who is the new president of the Royal Society, says fees, strict financial tests and NHS surcharges are deterring early career researchers. Supporters of the current system say charges help fund the NHS and address concerns about migration. The Home Office says 60 delivery riders will be deported after being found to be working in the UK illegally. They were detained during 7 days of immigration enforcement action across the country, which led to more than 170 arrests. And red squirrels can now be found in 25% more of the Highlands after a 10-year reintroduction project. The rewilding charity Trees for Life says more than a dozen new populations of reds are breeding successfully.
Thank you, Alan. It's 26 minutes to 8. Now that Russia's President Vladimir Putin has been found morally responsible for the death of Dawn Sturgis, who was poisoned near Salisbury 7 years ago after using a discarded perfume bottle containing a toxic agent, what, if anything at all, will change in the way that Russian agents are tracked in this country? Following Lord Hugh's report, the Prime Minister announced that Russia's main military intelligence agency, the GRU, would be sanctioned in its entirety. But Sturgis's family said they had still been left with a number of unanswered questions. Well, I asked John Glenn, the MP for Salisbury, if the report has brought a degree of closure for him and for the Sturgis family.
Well, I understand the family are not completely at peace with the outcome in the inquiry's report yesterday. I think it's obviously an absolute tragedy for them, but the reality is what the report says is that President Putin ordered this attack on the former intelligence officer Sergei Skripal from the Kremlin with horrendous consequences. And it was obviously a very reckless act with so many innocent bystanders like Dawn put at risk. And indeed, she lost her life consequential of that choice.
Do you feel that this inquiry has drawn out anything new, anything important?
Not really, but I think it has confirmed what was widely understood at the time, that this was something that was directed by President Putin from Kremlin as an act of him showing his power to the world, that he could reach into an English city, my city of Salisbury, and administer what was a pretty lethal action that had tragic consequences. It is very, very difficult to come to terms with the fact that there's not a lot we could have done about it. I think the report basically says that Mr. Skripal, though he'd been involved in an exchange with other agents previous years, there was obviously a, a vindictive mindset in Putin, and he was determined to show that nobody could be out with his reach.
Do you think there's been sufficient action taken against him?
Well, Theresa May, the Prime Minister at the time, and I think all ministers and governments since have done everything they can to sanction Russia in appropriate ways. And I'm very pleased that the existing government has gone further and sanctioned more named individuals from this elite intelligence agency yesterday. But the truth is, you know, Putin's values are not our values. And, you know, he chose to do this. And unfortunately, he was able to do it because of the nature of the networks that he's built up and the units that he uses.
What about your constituents? Do they feel that enough has been done? And do they feel safer now?
Well, I think Salisbury's an exceptionally special place with wonderful people who are very resilient. There's a strong military ethos and culture, a lot of people having grown up and trained around the military and military families. And I think it means that they are just used to just getting on with things. And I think we got back to normal quite quickly. Obviously, there was an economic legacy. We had great support from the government at the time, and money was invested in the city. It was quite a long time ago now, but obviously the impact on Dawn Sturgis's family, Charlie Rowley, her partner at the time, Sergeant Nick Bailey, who was essentially was hospitalised and never really returned to work, as well, of course, as Sergei and Julia Skripal, who we don't know where they are now, but they survived after an extended period in hospital. The implications were massive, but, you know, people move on, time moves on, and obviously COVID happened in between.
That's John Glenn, the MP for Salisbury. Well, Mark Urban is host of the Crisis Room podcast, the author of the Skripal Files and a former diplomatic and defence editor for Newsnight. Mark, good morning.
Good morning, Anna.
You've obviously spent a lot of time on this case and you've been looking through that report. What's your assessment of it?
Yes, look, it conclusively nails the question of responsibility. And indeed, it also attempts to provide the rationale from the Russian point of view, in that Lord Hughes talks about it as a public statement by Russia that the country would act decisively in what it regarded as its own interest. Now, you might say, well, so what? Most of us have long accepted it was Russia. But, you know, in the early days, when you look at the statements that were made in the Commons by Theresa May, things like that, there were these formulations like, it's highly likely it's Russia. And at the time, the Russians even made fun of that form of words. There were reasons for that caveated language. But the word sure and sure that was used many times by Lord Hughes in his report. And I guess that's the important point. Hence, also those announcements yesterday about the sanctioning of elements of the GRU agency and the agency itself.
Yeah, but people might be surprised that that wasn't already the case, should they be?
Yes. Look, I think where I would be surprised that there wasn't more in this report, or there wasn't a series of recommendations, and this is something that Dawn Sturgis's family also flagged up. They were disappointed there weren't recommendations around, you know, how people might have been better protected, or how the threat to Skripal might have been either discovered or mitigated in some way. Is, you know, there are still some quite big questions about how these Russians came in, you know, when investigation was done into them by the, you know, open source, non-governmental people at Bellingcat, you know, just gifted amateurs, if you like, they discovered the real identities of those Russian intelligence officers within, I think, 5 or 6 days of the initial warrants for their arrest being issued by the Metropolitan Police in their pseudonyms. You know, they discovered the real identities and all the rest of it, in part because the passports they had were very close in the sequencing of their numbers. They discovered other travels by those individuals. And indeed, in the inquiry, they talked about inconsistencies in their visa applications, lots of things like that. And the fact that they were able to travel, a couple of them, to the UK before, at almost exactly the same time the previous year, and we don't really know why that was. Was it a dry run? Was it a previous attempt, or was it a completely different mission? All of those sorts of things not really addressed, and therefore the idea that Russian spies could come into the country and do this, you know, we don't really know if things have been tightened in that sense.
Yeah, and that, I suppose that's one of the big issues, isn't it, Mark? Because the whole point of inquiries and subsequent reports like this are to identify the failings, the flaws, and make sure they can't happen again. But actually, what you're saying is it's hard to tell from this document whether those gaps have been plugged.
Yeah, those ones. I mean, Lord Hughes, he was mildly critical of the security service, which is responsible for the safety of agents, saying they should have conducted regular risk assessments into, you know, were the circumstances of Sergei Skripal being in the country changed. And that's kind of as far as it got. Now, intuitively, you know, there are certain things like the hacking of his daughter's phone that British intelligence did know before the poisoning that might have been flagged up by that sort of process. But yeah, the bigger question about, you know, can we now use big data and other methods to catch people like this or track them more effectively when they're in the country, unanswered.
Mark Urban, host of the Crisis Room podcast, thank you for joining us.
Time now is 17 minutes to 8. Australia are 174 for 2. The RSC meets the BFG. Roald Dahl's story about an orphan called Sophie, snatched away to the land of the giants, has been adapted for the stage by the Royal Shakespeare Company. Actors and huge puppets combine to share the same roles on a stage normally used just for Shakespeare. Instead of Banquo, Benvolio and Bottom, this Christmas it's the BFG and Blood Bottler who will be treading the boards. Our entertainment correspondent Colin Patterson has been behind the scenes in Stratford-upon-Avon.
Big friendly giant.
BFG for short.
Is this a snozcumber I see before me?
You literally pinched me from my bed.
Because you is seeing me.
At the home of the bard, a tale of the big, the very big.
I've loved the novel since I was a child.
Daniel Evans is the co-artistic director of the RSC.
It sort of teaches us you can be very small, but actually be mighty in your power. You can think that because someone is big, that they're powerful. But in fact, what Sophie learns is that the BFG himself is being bullied by an even bigger giant, the Blood Bottler.
Who is you jabbering to, runt? No one!
The device the show uses is scale shifting, where the same character is portrayed both by an actor and a puppet, often in the same scene.
You is talking to a human being?
Where are we? So we're backstage at the Royal Shakespeare Theatre. I'm Toby Ollier and I'm the puppetry director and designer of the BFG.
And you did Warhorse.
Yes, I was one of the original three puppeteers of Joey at the National Theatre, yeah. So this is BFG when Sophie is played by an actor, a child actor, and the BFG feels huge and enormous. Yeah. And then when the evil Blood Bottler knocks on the door, we go down a scale.
So BFG gets smaller.
So BFG becomes an actor and Sophie becomes this puppet.
That is disgusting!
This is a big one.
He's the biggest puppet in the show. This is Blood Bottler. Do you want to have a go?
Yes, I do.
So you can hold Sonny's arm. So you have this your dominant hand down on the handle there. Hand yeah, down.
It's quite heavy.
Yeah, right. He walks on his hands a bit like a sort of gorilla. Yeah. Ooh. Lifting with his knuckles. So then, and then you step. Yeah. And Parky steps. Yeah. And you step.
Oh, your brain is so full of bug whiffles, you can't understand.
But everyone's looking for me.
And the three actors who share the role of Sophie,
Elsie, Ellamy, Martha,
are certainly very excited.
It's magical. It's crazy. It's really fun.
What's the best bit?
I like Daydream. Lifts. We get lifted a lot.
And we get to fly.
I wonder when Blood Bottler's charging towards the front of the stage, do you think the audience are going to be, like, shrieking?
In front row, there's a bit where it gets really close and I think there might be a bit...
Yeah. And he vomits.
So don't sit
bit
in the front
splash.
Row? Or...
No, that side gets a bit wet.
Really?
Yeah, it's so fun.
It is.
Yeah.
To make Roald Dahl dazzling for a new generation, the show uses brand new technology.
Zoe, Akila, you've given me these. What are they for?
So they're called trackers. Pop them in your pockets. And then if you walk around stage, the light will follow.
Yeah.
This is like the Truman Show. Go on, show me something else.
The other thing we do is magic in the show. So can we turn on the sparkles, please, Ian? So this trail of particles will just stick to you in the show. And that can follow you around the stage.
I've got sparkles. You've given me magic.
Yeah. Trail of joy.
The RSC has had a Roald Dahl hit before. 15 years on, Matilda is still in the West End and crucial to their finances. And as Daniel Evans explains, this new production of the BFG has been made in partnership with others, including a theatre in Singapore.
We are eventually going to go to the Esplanade Theatre there, which is a very large theatre, larger than even the Royal Shakespeare Theatre. And so we feel very proud that this cast, after playing in Stratford, will then go to Chichester and then go to the East.
So Roald Dahl is popular in Singapore?
All over the world.
Yes, is this the future for British theatre? The magic of the BFG, brought to life in the West Midlands in collaboration with the Far East.
Come on, then.
We is off.
Colin Patterson reporting there from Stratford-upon-Avon. It's 13 minutes to 8.
And it's time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is Chinny McDonald, director of Theos, the religion and society think tank.
Good morning. This week, Wendy Dalrymple, canon pastor at Ripon Cathedral, shared on social media her experience of being in an abusive relationship when she was young. Like many other women who face violence at the hands of men they know, she was locked in a cycle of abuse, followed by remorse, followed by forgiveness, followed by more abuse. The relationship only ended when her then-boyfriend assaulted her in a public place, and onlookers intervened, telling him to stop and calling the police. We're in the middle of the UN's 16 days of activism to end gender-based violence, which highlights the bleak reality that one in three women experience some sort of abuse in their lifetime. To raise awareness, Ripon Cathedral's Leave Her Alone exhibition showcases art created by male prisoners, many of whom have been perpetrators of violence against women. It hopes to encourage all to speak out, drawing on the words of Jesus, who told his disciples to leave the woman who anointed his feet alone. But speaking out, intervening when we know or see someone is being abused, is easier said than done. Our instincts may push us towards self-protection and self-preservation. This week, Farah Naz, the aunt of murdered law graduate Zara Elina, called for a new law that would require bystanders to step in when they see people in danger. Her calls follow the publication of a report by Lady Elish Angelini into the prevention of sexually motivated crimes against women in public. Among the recommendations, which come 4 years after the rape and murder of Sarah Everard, was one suggesting the government implement a so-called Good Samaritan law. Speaking on the Today programme earlier this week, she said such a law, requiring people to step in if they can reasonably help someone in danger, would create a culture change and encourage us all to see the safety of women in public as a whole society action. Whether or not a Good Samaritan law will or even could be implemented is one thing, but I think a society in which we notice and try to help others in need, even against our own interests, is the kind of idea at the heart of the Christian story. Drawing on the parable of the Good Samaritan, Martin Luther King, in a speech the day before he was killed, pointed out that it's reasonable to ask, when confronted with another in need, if I stop to help, what will happen to me? But for King, the motivating question for the Good Samaritan is instead, if I don't stop to help this person, what will happen to them? Perhaps this motivating question can help us to recognise that when it comes to the scourge of violence against women in our societies, we are all our sister's keepers.
That was Thought for the Day with Chinny McDonald, Director of Theos, the Religion and Society Think Tank. It's 10 to 8.
What do we do or have as a country that we can honestly say we do better than anyone in the world? Well, how about our scientific pedigree? This is the country of Newton's apple and laws of motion, of the discovery of the structure of DNA, the invention of vaccines, the discovery of penicillin, of locomotives, of natural selection, of Rutherford, Turing, Newton, Hawking, Darwin, Alexander Fleming, Ada Lovelace, Dorothy Hodgkin, Mary Somerville, Mary Anning, Jocelyn Bell Burnell, and Michael Faraday, of the invention of computing and the internet, of graphene, the so-called miracle material, of Tim Berners-Lee and Demis Hassabis, and Paul Nurse. And yet today, according to one of those names, we are jeopardising our scientific future, in particular, perhaps with a visa system that stops great minds coming here to advance
common knowledge. Well, Professor Sir Paul Nurse, I mentioned in that list, the new president of the Royal Society, which is the body which champions science in this country, and a winner of the Nobel Prize for his extraordinary work on the cell cycle, joins us now. Professor Sir Paul, good morning.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
You look like you wanted to correct me when I define the Royal Society thus.
Well, I'd say it's actually even more important than what you said, because I would say it's now the most important science academy in the world, given what's happening in the United States at the present time, which is muzzling scientists and muzzling the academy because they, frankly, are scared. So we have a particular responsibility for the world to promote science, to explain how science is so important for societal goods, important for economic growth. It's really central to society and should be central to government. And that's
what are we getting wrong? I mean, you want is your... In your designation as president of the Royal Society, to say that we are getting certain things wrong, let's do it under two headings. People first, and then secondly, money. In terms of people, are we supporting the people we've got, and are we getting the people we need?
We are doing well, but we mustn't be complacent. We, as you gave this great list of achievements, and we've done it recently too, but there is a sort of whiff of complacency, if you may. Funding isn't as good as it should be. I mean, obviously we're grateful we're not being reduced in the present economic situation, but we need to recognise we are only providing 0.5%. The government is only providing 0.5% of its GDP for science it supports. That's halfway down the OECD table. So it's not brilliant. The funding isn't brilliant, and we need to recognise that. But that's only one part of it. The second part of it is how we deliver the funding. We're being a bit casual about it. We need to really look at it root and branch so we actually direct funding in the right way and to the right people.
Just on the point about funding, we'll come back maybe to this issue of visas. But on the funding, the government did announce an £86 billion funding package for R&D in June. That works out at about £22.5 billion annually by 2029-30. And there's also this ARIA, the ARIA, the Advanced Research and Invention Agency. On those two fronts, isn't the government doing a bit?
As I said, I think they're doing as well as could be expected in the present economic circumstances. But that isn't an excuse for complacency, because we are still halfway down the OECD league table. So whenever they have an opportunity, they should be putting money in science, because it is such a positive thing to do and will lead to economic growth.
What about visas? Have we got the right people coming in?
Well, that's an example. Visas. You know, why make visas so expensive that it puts people off? Scientists don't get paid that much, and it does put people off. And what we're trying to do is not only train good scientists in the UK, which obviously is central, but attract the very best in the world. Now, if they come here and see these really massive visa and associated costs, it puts them off. They think, well, we're not welcoming. They see that their pay packet is reduced. It is totally fixable. You make an exclusion so that they're not being charged that, because they are going to contribute to things like health and so on in ways that nobody else can.
Well, of course, the government is responding to public concern about migration numbers. Government, the Home Office says, and I put to you what they say. They say, they say the government is committed to ensuring the UK remains the natural home for world-leading science and research. Many other countries require applicants to have private healthcare insurance as a condition of the visa. This is often more expensive, may incur excess payments, and may not provide the same level of coverage as gained via access to the NHS. So they're responding to public concern, aren't they?
Well, there's a lot of words there, I would say, and I'm not sure that...
Verbiage, you might argue.
Yeah, I'm not sure it actually deals with the problem. Those coming in are paying, of course, taxes. They're paying national insurance. So, I mean, they do contribute. But I repeat, many of them are actually contributing to trying to improve healthcare. I mean, just think about that.
A lot of people would say the great technology of our age is AI. And that if you look across the globe, actually, behind China and the US, some people say we're kind of in sort of third spot, doing okay. And worse, Sir Keir Starmer here, I'm sure you'll have the pleasure of speaking to him at length about your concerns. He might say, we just can't win with you scientists. We commission a review by Matt Clifford, the entrepreneur, on AI. He comes up with 50-odd recommendations. We say we'll pursue all of his recommendations. And still, Paul Nurse goes on the Today programme and gives us hell.
Well, I don't think I've mentioned AI yet, so I don't think they can say yet I'm giving him hell over AI. I think that we have some great AI researchers here. I mean, Demis, who you mentioned, and John Jumpers, also. And they are my colleagues in King's Cross, and I've known Demis for 25 years. They are committed to trying to get commercial applications for AI, and AI has a significant role to play in discovery research as well. It is expensive, so we have to balance that with everything else that we do. It isn't going to answer all problems, and we don't yet have the artificial intelligence that we need for all the problems we need to solve, particularly in science, which is not all able to respond to the sorts of tools that can be applied at this present time. It may be able to, but not quite yet.
Can I ask you finally, Sir Paul, about Elon Musk? He was elected a Fellow of the Royal Society in 2018. I think you've written to him a bit of late, but perhaps not yet received a reply. Correct me if I'm wrong. Are you happy for Elon Musk to remain a Fellow of the Royal Society?
Happy isn't the right word exactly. Elon Musk was elected on the basis of his contributions in promoting science, rockets and electric cars. That's why we elect fellows. We don't always elect people we like. We don't always elect people you want to go and have dinner with. But that is, or they may express political opinions we have no, really don't like. But that isn't what the Royal Society is about. However, we can criticise that, and I did indeed write to him, not so much about his political opinions. I mean, you know, I'm sort of, I don't like them, but that's something different. It's because he wasn't defending American science in the public sector. And I said, if you can't do that, then you have to ask yourself, do you want to be a Fellow of the Royal Society? And if not, consider resignation.
Okay. Professor Sir Paul Nurse, as ever, thank you very much indeed for coming in.
Thank you.
Friday evening means any questions, and Alex Forsyth is here to tell us about tonight's morning. Alex?
Good morning, Anna. Tonight we are in Billingham, a town on Teesside in the northeast of England, and there is a lot that might come up this week, whether it's continued budget fallout, child poverty, energy bills, industry, given where we'll be, or the war in Ukraine. On our panel, ready to address whatever our audience wants to raise, we have the Labour peer Baroness Shami Chakrabarty, the former Conservative Minister Graham Stewart, the FT columnist Gillian Tett, and the political editor of GB News, Christopher Hope. We'll be live at 8 p.m. Hope you can join us.
Thank you very much indeed. Look forward to that. And Helen Willits has got the weather.
Very quick rundown for today. It's getting wet from the west. So rain and wind spreading across Northern Ireland, Wales and Western England. Gales around the coast. Heavy rain for several hours. It'll also get into the southwest of Scotland. To the east of that, it's cold this morning. We've got frost quite widely across England and Wales, Southern Scotland too. We have patchy, dense fog across southern and eastern counties of England to watch out for as well. So some hazards on the roads because it's freezing fog, and yesterday's rain still to clear across eastern Scotland, but some drier weather, as I say, between those two systems. So we will keep some sunshine eventually in the north and east of Scotland, eastern parts of England, but temperatures still on the low side, 6 or 7, feeling chilly in eastern areas, 9 or 10 with the rain and those gale force winds.
Thank you, Helen. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Amol Rajan and Anna Foster.
It's 8 o'clock on Friday, the 5th of December. The headlines this morning. More countries are considering a boycott of the Eurovision Song Contest after four pulled out because of a refusal to expel Israel. The government is pledging to stop children growing up in bed and breakfast accommodation as part of its plan to tackle child poverty. The biggest study so far of the impact of deep sea mining has found it causes significant damage to life on the ocean floor. Joining us to tell us more is a deep sea scientist from the Natural History Museum.
And also coming up before nine, with the government review announced into the prevalence of mental health conditions, we'll take a look at the impact on the workplace with Sir Charlie Mayfield. And world-renowned pianist Lang Lang will be with us explaining how he's using music like that to help children with physical and mental illnesses. Before all of that, though, the BBC News is read by Alan Smith.
The Eurovision Song Contest has been thrown into turmoil after four countries said they would boycott next year's event. Ireland, Spain, the Netherlands and Slovenia had wanted Israel to be excluded because of the war in Gaza, but a meeting of the European Broadcasting Union said the country could take part. The managing director of Eurovision said the contest had to keep a sense of neutrality, but more countries could still pull out. Here's our music correspondent Mark Savage.
This is the biggest crisis in Eurovision's 70-year history, with little sign that the differences over Israel's role can be resolved. Germany welcomed the decision not to disqualify the country, and the BBC said it supported the collective decision of Eurovision's member states. But there is still a possibility that more countries could pull out, including Belgium and Iceland. The Spanish broadcaster, RTVE, has been particularly outspoken about how the row has been handled, saying it has lost faith in Eurovision's organisers. The chair of Slovenia's national broadcaster said the precedent set when Russia was excluded should be continued, arguing that no aggressor should take part. In response, Israel accused critics of trying to silence it. The former Eurovision winner, Dana International, said the decision of four countries to boycott was violent and insulting and added to hatred. With such deep divisions, it's hard to envisage a path to reconciliation for the Eurovision family.
The government has promised to lift around 550,000 children out of poverty by 2030 in its child poverty strategy. There will be more help with upfront childcare costs for families on universal credit and measures to reduce stays in bed and breakfast accommodation. Housing charities say the improvements are just a sticking plaster, but children's charities have broadly welcomed the strategy. Our reporter Vanessa Clark has more.
Across the UK, 4.5 million children are living in poverty. That's one in three children, mostly in working families. Key changes in the child poverty strategy already announced include scrapping the two-child benefit cap from April next year and extending free school meals to all families on universal credit. Measures such as extending help with upfront childcare costs and extra funding for councils to improve temporary accommodation are expected to affect much smaller groups of people, according to the think tank, the Institute for Fiscal Studies. The most recent figures showed there were, at the end of June, just over 2,000 households with children in England who'd been in B&B accommodation for more than the legal limit of 6 weeks. The government has confirmed that it'll extend a pilot programme to try to end this across 20 local authorities.
The Minister for Local Government and Homelessness, Alison McGovern, told this programme the poverty strategy, including an extra £8 million to tackle the issue of temporary accommodation. She said it would make a real difference.
This use of B&B accommodation really clusters in a few areas that have got the most acute housing crises. But what we know is that because some places have taken steps to acquire better temporary accommodation and to reduce the use of B&B, we know it can be done. Local councils have been massively underfunded over the past 15 years, so we need to make sure they've got the resources to do the job.
The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, has said a comment he made earlier this year about mental health conditions being overdiagnosed failed to capture the complexity of the problem. Mr Streeting said the more evidence was needed, and that was why he'd ordered a review to examine what was driving the rise in demand for mental health, ADHD and autism services. Our health correspondent Catherine Burns reports.
Wes Streeting is calling it his own episode with foot-in-mouth syndrome on live television. In March, he was asked by the BBC's Laura Koonsberg about overdiagnosis in mental health. At the time, he said there was overdiagnosis, but went on to say that too many people didn't get the support they needed. Now, writing in The Guardian, he's stepped back, admitting that his views on overdiagnosis were divisive and that he had failed to capture the complexity of the problem. Wes Streeting has ordered an independent review and wants it to offer recommendations about how to fix a system that is not keeping up with patients' needs.
The US military says it's conducted another strike on a boat suspected of carrying illegal drugs, this time in the Eastern Pacific, killing four people. Earlier, armed forces commanders briefed members of Congress on a double strike on a boat in September after questions were raised about whether such attacks were legal. Our North America correspondent Peter Bowes reports.
In a statement on the social media platform X, the US military said the latest attack occurred after intelligence confirmed that the vessel was carrying illegal narcotics along a known narco-trafficking route. Alongside video of the attack, the statement says the strike was carried out at the direction of the US Defense Secretary, Pete Hegseth. Earlier, lawmakers were shown video of a September attack involving two strikes on a boat that killed two stranded sailors. The Democratic Senator Jack Reed said he was deeply disturbed by what he'd seen and called for the video to be released to the public.
President Putin of Russia has told India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi that he wants the two countries to move forward their relations. They're holding talks in Delhi, which are expected to focus on trade and defence spending. The two countries are expected to sign a number of deals, despite US pressure on Delhi to scale back its links to Moscow. One of Britain's most distinguished scientists says the UK's scientific future is being put at risk by the government's visa system. The Nobel Prize winner, Professor Sir Paul Nurse, says fees, strict financial tests and NHS surcharges are deterring early career researchers who could instead choose to live in the US, Asia or mainland Europe. Supporters of the current system say the measures help fund the NHS and address concerns about migration. But Sir Paul told us the costs discourage people from coming to the UK.
If they come here and see these really massive visa and associated costs, it puts them off. They think that we're not welcoming. They see that their pay packet is reduced. It is totally fixable. You make an exclusion so that they're not being charged that, because they are going to contribute to things like health and so on in ways that nobody else can.
The Home Office says 60 delivery riders will be deported after being found to be working illegally in the UK. They were detained during 7 days of immigration enforcement action across the country last month. Simon Jones reports.
The government has recognised that the apparent ease with which people who have no right to work in the UK can get a job acts as a significant pull factor for migrants. The Home Office has carried out what it's described as a national enforcement blitz, in which 171 delivery riders were arrested in the space of 7 days. 60 of them have been detained for removal from the UK. The Border Security Minister, Alex Norris, has also met representatives from the food delivery firms to encourage them to do more to tackle the issue, such as using facial recognition checks to prevent illicit account sharing.
The largest study so far of the impact of deep-sea mining has found that it causes significant damage to animal life on the ocean floor. Vast amounts of the critical minerals which are needed for green technologies are locked up in the seabed, but mining isn't permitted until more is known about the environmental consequences. Our climate and science correspondent Georgina Ranard has more details.
At the heart of the deep-sea mining controversy is a difficult problem. The world needs critical minerals to tackle climate change, but extracting them from the seafloor could cause serious environmental harm. This research by the Natural History Museum and National Oceanography Centre analysed the impact of trial mining in the Pacific Ocean. It found that where the mining vehicle had harvested minerals, the number of animals living in the area was reduced by 37%. The deep ocean is barely explored, and many scientists worry it harbours vital life that could be lost if mining goes ahead. The mining firm The Metals Company commissioned the research. A spokesperson said they were encouraged by findings that animals outside of the directly mined areas were not affected.
Cricket and Australia are continuing to pile on the runs in their first innings on the second day of the second Ashes test in Brisbane. A short time ago, they were 196 for three. They're replying to England's first innings total of 334.
Thank you, Alan. It's just coming round to 10 minutes past eight. I failed to capture the complexity of the problem. It was an episode of Foot in Mouth Syndrome on live television. The words of the Health Secretary Wes Streeting there, writing for The Guardian on mental health. He has stepped back now from comments that he made earlier this year to Laura Koonsberg on her programme when she asked him if there was a problem with overdiagnosis.
Do you believe, as the Health Secretary, that too many people are being treated as sick and incapable of work for essentially struggling with what are quite normal feelings?
Well, I want to follow the evidence, and I agree with that point about overdiagnosis. But here's the other thing. I mean, mental well-being, illness, it's a spectrum, right?
And but you do think,
I think there's definitely, there's an overdiagnosis, but also there are too many people being written off. And to your point about treatment, there's too many people who just aren't getting the support they need.
Well, Wes Streeting says that position brought both enthusiastic agreement and visceral disagreement. And he acknowledges that it was a divisive view. So what he's done now is commissioned a review into both the prevalence of and the support for mental health conditions, including things like autism and ADHD. Slightly over one in three young people aged between 18 and 24 have reported symptoms of a common mental health disorder like depression, anxiety and bipolar. 25 years ago, that figure figure was just under a quarter. And those people are also more likely to be out of work than their peers who don't have mental health conditions. So let's look at the impact on the workplace in particular, both on employers and employees, with Sir Charlie Mayfield, former chairman of John Lewis, who also led the government's Keep Britain Working review, joins us in the studio. Sir Charlie, good morning.
Good morning, Anna.
Before we get into the detail of this, I thought that that point that Wes Streeting made was interesting. He said it was a divisive view. He said he had this enthusiastic agreement and visceral disagreement. Was that something that, you found when you did your review?
I'm not a politician, so I think I probably get a slightly different experience. But I can totally see why you'd see that kind of reaction, because on the one hand, you're going to have people who have got conditions and are feeling that the suggestion that even they might be accused of being overdiagnosed is deeply offensive. But on the other hand, I think you have a lot of other people who would feel that there probably is an overdiagnosis problem. So I think it's the fact it's divisive, the fact it's a bit controversial is, to my mind, a very good reason why we do need to be talking about this and we do need to be discussing how we make it better. And I think the diagnosis issue and the fact that the review is being commissioned into it is probably a pretty good response to that.
Yeah, I mean, one of the really difficult, and the reason we're talking about it this morning, actually, one of the difficult paths to tread is in the workplace, because you have people who have a right to go to work, to be supported while you're there. But you also have businesses, particularly small businesses, who can struggle under the weight of making certain accommodations. So how do we negotiate that push-pull?
Well, I think this is very much what we've been looking at within the review that I led. The fact is that I've almost yet to meet an employer who's not concerned about mental health issues, particularly amongst young people. This is, almost whatever the diagnosis issue is, this is an issue which is manifesting itself for employers right now. And I'll give you an example. I was talking to an employer the other day. I won't name them, but they're a very large employer of apprentices. And they were saying that, and I'm talking hundreds, if not thousands, of apprentices each year. And they were saying that they've seen a marked shift in the course of the last 5-6 years from a position where they had very few issues with anxiety and anxiousness, etc., to one now where about a third of their intake basically are starting with some form of early stage mental health issue. Now, these are going to be very, very capable people who've got onto those programs. So, this is a real issue. And of course, that employer is dealing with it. They're saying, OK, so this is what we've got in front of us. We need to deal with that, support these people, get them through that. And actually, very often what people will become is far more resilient as a result of going through difficult issues. So I think the notion that people have a manifestation of mental health is not a lifetime, in many cases, not a lifetime thing. It's something you have to help people through. And employers are really well placed to do that, in fact.
So the employers that you're talking to, is it more a scaling up of things that are already in place? Or actually, for some of them, is this something brand new that they're now thinking, right, we need to work out how to deal with this?
It's both. So I think on the first instance, probably it's worth saying that you have to deal with this. So I think there is almost a danger when we talk about overdiagnosis that there's almost an implication this isn't really real, and therefore there's perhaps a tendency to think therefore I shouldn't have to deal with this. I don't agree with that. I do think there is a real issue which employers do need to address. And when employers do that, they find that actually they can make quite a big difference with relatively simple interventions. I mean, it's about creating a supportive working environment. It's about recognizing that the person in front of you, probably does need to be, you need to be clear with them about what the requirements are. You may have to be a bit more thoughtful about if they're finding something difficult, more difficult than you perhaps think they should. You can't sort of wish that person to be somebody different. You've got to deal with who's in front of you and lean in. And if you do that, you can actually get some great results. I mean, fundamentally, performance in an organization is a function of creating the conditions where all the people in it are able to perform well. So you've got to deal with who you've got.
You talked about resilience, and I mentioned those figures at the very start, how the number of young people, specifically aged between 18 and 24, who've reported symptoms of a common mental health disorder has gone up quite a lot in the last few years. And I suppose it's really difficult to know whether that is people's mental health generally getting worse, or whether it's that people are more tuned in as to what good and bad mental health is, because we're talking about it more, or whether our resilience is slipping. Because you look back at times gone by, decades gone by, times of war, where people weren't talking about mental health, but presumably it did have an impact on people's lives. It's sort of hard to work out where and what and why, really, isn't it?
It is, but I think there's, if we unpick it a bit, there's a few things. I mean, first of all, that there has been a marked increase in the incidence of mental health issues in young people, but that began back in about 2014. So I think there is a rising tide of diagnosable mental health issues amongst young people. You then have this question as to whether how much of that rising tide is sort of due to overdiagnosis or due to a real incidence. And that's a very difficult thing to unpick. But I think that's why I think the review that Wes Streeting's announced is helpful, because some serious qualified people are going to have a hard look at that question, which I think is a good thing. But I think when it comes to the young people themselves, I mean, I've met several young people who have told me they've got this and this and this and this and this, various different conditions, and they're incredibly articulate about it. I have to tell you, they haven't struck me as lacking any kind of resilience. Actually, they're just very clear about what they need to perform. Now, I suspect that for some employers, they will find that quite demanding because they're sort of expected to respond to that. But I also suspect that if you look back in history, most generations, it probably have intergenerational pressures like that, where I would imagine that, 25 years ago, people were saying that the current lot of people coming into the workforce are more demanding, or they don't do the things that we used to do 20 years previously. So I think we've got to sort of unpick this a bit. And I think, therefore, a review like the one that's been announced is helpful because that unpicks a piece of it. I do think, we need to make sure that employers recognise they've got to deal with what's in front of them. There's a lot they can do. And one of the things we're going to do on the review is help to people to understand that and also put in place better support to enable people to support people with who've got early stage mental health issues.
Yeah, on that point, what does that review need to produce in order to be genuinely useful for everybody? Obviously, people will look at it, there'll be numbers, there'll be findings, but how can that actually become something that makes things better for everybody, particularly in the workplace?
So, I mean, in brief, everybody's got to do a bit more, basically. So employers do need to play a role. I mean, that they have to be on the pitch in terms of sort of really taking a frontline role in helping their people to deal with the mental health issues that they show up to work with. Pretending anything different is wrong. And employers have got a unique opportunity actually to do things early that can make huge differences. They can be the difference between whether somebody develops a full-blown issue or not. So they have a critical role to play and will be essentially getting into what are the practicalities of how you do that and how you create the right mechanisms to support and enable them to do it. Quickly, it's worth saying that we need to think also about line managers, because actually it's difficult sometimes to deal with mental health. You can't expect line managers to be able to understand every single situation that they're facing. So you have to support them just as much as you do actually employees. Employees have a role to play because there is lots of evidence to say that actually being in work is both positive and protective of your mental health. And the truth is that work's not always easy. You have good days and you have bad days, but you kind of have to push through the bad days to get to the good ones. And also you do develop, part of your development in employment is a function of getting through difficult times. That's the whole point. So I do think that, deciding to sort of say, I can't cope, and stepping back is, for most people, a bad move for their long-term prospects, both mental health-wise and in terms of their progression. And then the government obviously has a key role to play. I mean, I think the government absolutely is responsible for thinking about issues like diagnosis and some of the system issues. But also, down the track, what we said in the review, the government's going to have a key role to play in making sure that we got the incentive systems and all of those systems lined up in the right way that encourages employers to do what they need to do, employees to do what they need to do, all within a system which is supportive of positive outcomes.
So, Charlie Mayfield, always really interesting to get your insight. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Time now is 20 past eight. Vladimir Putin arrived in India yesterday for a two-day visit as part of the country's annual summit, Russia and India. He received a warm embrace from India's Narendra Modi. The two leaders are embarking on a press conference shortly. In an interview with India Today, Putin said of the war in Ukraine, "Either we take back these territories by force or eventually Ukrainian troops withdraw." What is the nature of this relationship between Russia and India? Well, in a moment, we're going to speak to a former Indian foreign secretary. But first, Steve Rosenberg, our Russia editor, is in Delhi. Steve, good morning. What's the mood music where you are, Steve?
Good morning to you. Well, I'm back at the India-Russia Business Forum outside. A lot of journalists queuing up to go in because a little bit later this afternoon, Prime Minister Modi and President Putin will come here, make speeches. I think, you know, for both Russia and India, this is an important visit. There was a really colourful headline in one of the Russian papers this morning. The elephant and the bear are looking for new paths through the fog of sanctions. And I think that kind of sums up the situation. I mean, both countries are keen to boost cooperation, to deepen their strategic partnership. Russia objectively under pressure from literally thousands of international sanctions that have been imposed on it. And grateful to India for buying large amounts of Russian oil. And India now under pressure from America, the US having slapped, you know, big tariffs on Indian goods to try to stop India from buying Russian oil. So I think this is going to be top of the agenda, trying to find workarounds around these sort of sanctions and tariffs.
And Steve, for the UK, as perhaps for the US, the main sort of point or edge of diplomacy with Russia concerns Ukraine. For India, as you say, there's a kind of economic partnership. How are the Indians and Modi in particular feeling about whether or not they want to take a view on Ukraine? Do they approach that with caution?
It's a difficult one, I think, for India, because on the one hand, India, you know, wants to maintain relations with Ukraine, but also it wants wants to deepen this partnership with Russia. So Prime Minister Modi did talk about Ukraine today. He mentioned quite generally that India was on the side of peace, that the welfare of nations is on the side of peace. The world will once again return to the direction of peace. So quite general statements. But I think the most interesting thing is, yesterday, Prime Minister Modi and President Putin had this 2.5-hour, what's been described as an informal dinner. And perhaps that, we've already seen the most important part of this visit, that dinner. Interestingly, Vladimir Putin's foreign policy aide, Yuri Ushakov, was quoted in the government paper today saying as that was one of the most important parts of the visit, because during such face-to-face contacts, he said, the most urgent, sensitive issues are discussed. Politics is made at these kind of meetings. Now, we don't know what was discussed over dinner, but, you know, probably the economic question, international affairs, but it seems that event last night, that dinner, was key in this two-day visit.
Steve Rosenberg, thank you very much, Steve. Plenty more from Steve, of course, throughout the day across BBC platforms, including the BBC website. Let's turn to Nirupama Rao, former Foreign Secretary of India from 2009 to 2011. By the way, the Foreign Secretary in India is a civil service role. She's also former ambassador to the US, former ambassador to China, and former High Commissioner to Sri Lanka, and joins us from Bangalore. Ms. Rao, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us on the Today programme. Just in broad terms first, what does India want from its relationship with Russia and Mr. Putin specifically?
Well, first and foremost, I'd like to place it in context. India's first priority is sovereign choice. And as you know, we have a foreign policy, I need hardly explain that, that is built on strategic autonomy, and we keep working relationships with all the major powers, even when those powers are in serious conflict with another. So I'd like to emphasize, firstly, that hosting President Putin isn't an endorsement of anything that Russia may be doing in Ukraine. It is actually about protecting our long-term, India's long-term defense interests, its energy interests, and keeping a channel open at a time when channels are closing. I know much of the West may see him, may see Putin, Mr. Putin, as persona non grata, but our responsibilities as India are shaped by our geography, our security needs, and our economic realities, not by the politics of other regions.
You use the phrase, Ms. Rao, as strategic autonomy. Autonomy is the right or condition of self-government, being able to basically determine your own affairs. Does India also want to be strategically neutral? That is, in a multipolar world with rising great power rivalry and so forth, India wants to not take a view as to whether it's associated with the West and NATO on the one hand or China on the other hand, for instance.
I don't believe you can assign a label like neutrality. I know it's convenient to describe our position as being neutral. I think this is very issue-based, and this is entirely dictated by India's interests. So when you talk of us not taking sides, I think you have to understand that we are taking our own side. We are acting in our own interests. And when you speak of what is the dreadful conflict in Ukraine, I think your audiences in the West should understand that this war grew out of tensions involving Europe, Russia and the United States, and the global South, of which India is very much a part, did not choose this conflict. But we in the global South, in India, we are living with the consequences, whether it's energy markets, whether it's food prices, and of course, the surrounding political uncertainty. So when you speak of the position, you know, the tightrope that India may be walking, it is essentially to manage these consequences, these fallouts responsibly, protect our own people and keep the space open for diplomacy.
Given your long and distinguished career in diplomacy, obviously you're very used to walking that tightrope, and I know you use your words very, very carefully indeed. But and also India obviously played no particular role in Mr. Putin's decision to invade and then reinvade Ukraine. But just to put to you the UK's position and that of, to some degree, the US and indeed NATO, the feeling is that the Putin administration did in 2014 with Crimea and then three and a bit years ago, did invade a sovereign country, which Ukraine is, a sovereign European democracy, and has unleashed terrible damage there. What's your view as to whether or not the invasion and reinvasion of Ukraine was justified?
I think any war, and I'm speaking of wars all over the world, that involve the deaths, the injuries to innocent citizens and especially to children can never be condoned. And I think India is very much on the side of understanding and speaking out against the humanitarian consequences of this war. And at the same time, on many occasions in the past, we've spoken of the need to preserve the principles of territorial integrity and sovereignty of Ukraine, which is an independent country, a country with which we have diplomatic relations. And we certainly do not disregard the importance of that relationship. But again, coming back to the point I made, this war was not a consequence of actions taken by us. We are very much removed from the region, the geographical region where the conflict is taking place. But more importantly, we did not contribute in any way to the causes of this conflict. Today, what India and what Mr. Modi they're saying is that we must see peace. We must see a sustainable peace. We don't want a peace that is made over Ukraine, but we want a peace that is made with Ukraine.
Nirupama Rao, former Foreign Secretary of India, thank you very much indeed for joining us from Bangalore.
It's 29 minutes past eight. Jonathan Ledyard.
Morning.
Yes. Well, yeah, I'm trying to find the words, but there aren't really any at the moment.
If you're an England cricket fan, no, it's quite hard going, isn't it, really? Because a lot of the England cricketers are chasing balls around the boundary. Australia's batsmen making hay in pursuit of England's first innings total of 334. Joe Root ended up 138 not out. Henry Moran can bring us up to date on a second day and the second test with precious few pickings for England's bowlers.
Yes, three wickets have fallen in the Australia innings, but so many runs have been scored, 214 of them in the space of just 41 overs. England have bowled with a lack of discipline, I think it's fair to say. In the field, they've been ragged. One really poor drop from the wicketkeeper, Jamie Smith, offering a life to Travis Head when on just three. And England are finding it hard going under the floodlights here in Brisbane. Cameron Green on 14. The old adversary, Stephen Smith, on 18. And Australia at 214 for three, trailed by just 120 runs.
Thank you, Henry. So how are England going to dig themselves out of this hole? Let's talk to an Ashes hero from Headingley 2019, spinner Jack Leach. Good morning, Jack.
Hi, how are you?
Well, I think we're all better than probably Ben Stokes and his team are feeling, and you're probably feeling it too as a teammate recently. Just out of interest, just picking up on what Henry said there, how difficult is it for a bowler in these conditions, twilight, with a pink ball, which is different, as we learnt from Glenn McGrath an hour ago?
I think it's a good time to be bowling. I think it kind of changes again, obviously, during the day. It seems a good time to bat. The ball's probably gone a bit soft now at 40 overs old. And now it maybe starts to zip around a little bit and move a little bit more off the seam. So hopefully, for England's sake, that this is a good period for them and they get a couple of wickets.
One over so far for spinner Will Jacks. Are you surprised at that? It's all pace so far?
No, not. I think England see their seam attack as the way they're going to kind of do most of the damage. I think I wouldn't be surprised if Jacksy comes into it at some point during the evening session to give the seamers a little bit of a rest from one end. So, yeah, hopefully he can get a good spell in and take some confidence from that.
How do you flip the mentality when the scoreboard makes such tough reading? You're thinking, gosh, what do we do now?
Yeah, it is probably the toughest thing. And I think it's the thing that Stokesy as skipper is so good at leading with. And whatever's happened before, it's all about focusing on what's next in the game and how you can make an impact on the game. So, yeah, they'll definitely be thinking about this period as something they can take advantage of and hopefully swing the game back in England's favour.
You memorably kept Ben Stokes company in that match-winning partnership of 73 to win the third test by a wicket. What is it about Ben Stokes which inspires?
I think he just leads from the front in everything he does. He doesn't ask you to do anything that he wouldn't be prepared to do himself. We've seen him bowl long spells, and even in that Headingley game, obviously, he played an unbelievable innings, but in that third innings with the ball, he bowled over a 10-over spell and really swung the game back, you know, and gave us a target that was maybe possible. So yeah, I think it's the effort and the endeavour that he puts in is something amazing to watch, and then it's something that you really want to replicate and try and live up to as well.
Talking about living up to, what about Joe Root? What's he like as a teammate? Because that century yesterday is 40th overall, his first ever in Australia. That was masterful. I mean, what does he bring to a dressing room?
A lot of calm. He's someone who's... Well, he's completed it now officially, and I think I was amazed to see how much chat there was around, you know, can he do it in Australia? I think he's such a class player, and I think he's respected all around the world by everyone he plays against, and Australia for sure know what a good player he is. And so it's funny, isn't it? Like, someone that good is still trying to prove himself in certain ways, and he loves that. And I've just got not enough good things to say about him in the dressing room. He's great to play with, and he's always putting the team first. And he's obviously an amazing player.
Briefly then, the last question. How damaging if England lose this match, which is not being Ben Stokes and being positive? I know that. I'm not going hard like Baz McCallum would like it, but they've got to win this, haven't they, England? Otherwise, it's good night.
I think, 2-0 down in Australia would be a very tough place to be. It does feel like they need to win, and there's a long way to go. I think this next part of the game today is going to be really important in how this game goes, and it needs to go England's way because we don't want to be 2-0 down.
You've nailed it. Thank you very much, Jack Leach. Great to talk to you. Come and see us again. Thank you so much. One day you'll be selected by England again, hopefully. Anyway, Test Match Special continues, of course, on 5 Extra and BBC Sounds. World Cup draw at 5 o'clock this afternoon, and first practice for Formula One's title decider in Abu Dhabi this weekend starts in an hour.
Thank you, Jonathan. Weather today, expect showers in the northeast of Scotland, mostly dry elsewhere, but it will turn windy with some rain pushing in later.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Amol Rajan. It's 25 minutes to 9. Here's a summary of the news from Alan Smith.
Next year's Eurovision Song Contest is facing disarray after four nations refused to take part because of Israel's involvement. Ireland, the Netherlands, Spain and Slovenia had wanted Israel to be excluded because of the war in Gaza. The European Broadcasting Union chose to allow Israel to keep competing. The government is promising to lift around 500,000 children out of poverty by 2030. It's unveiling its child poverty strategy today, which will include more help with upfront childcare costs for families on universal credit. One of Britain's most distinguished scientists says the UK's scientific future is being put at risk by the government's immigration system, including visa fees and NHS surcharges. The Nobel Prize winner, Professor Sir Paul Nurse, told us the costs discourage people from coming to the UK. Supporters say the measures address concerns about migration.
And Russia's President Putin has told India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi that he wants the two countries to move their relations forward. They're holding talks in Delhi, likely to focus on trade and defence spending.
Alan, thank you very much indeed. It's 24 minutes to nine. How should we talk to young people about pornography, particularly in the age of AI? Artificial intelligence has profound implications for porn because users can customise their demands with pretty instant results. Given the growing number of people for whom digital porn is their first encounter with any sexual activity and the growing prevalence of horrible phenomena such as choking on digital porn and which can be seen in real-world social trends too, this really matters. An influential voice in these issues and broader discussions about masculinity, addiction and sex education is Jordan Stevens, one half of the hugely successful hip-hop duo Rizzle Kicks. He wants us to have much more open and honest conversations about this, which is why he came on our podcast Radical this week and why he's joined a major new campaign by Lad Bible, one of the biggest youth publishers in the world. In that spirit, a warning that what you're about to hear does contain references to male genitalia, masturbation and violent sex. I began by asking him why he wanted to take part in this campaign.
As someone who had, I've had a very complicated relationship with sex for, you know, all types of reasons, I think it would really help boys and men to have a more open discussion about how to engage with porn in a healthy way, not to dismiss it, not to repress, not to shame, but to understand that, you know, a lot of porn isn't real life. And that is in keeping with what I want to do, which is, you know, constantly try and align myself and create spaces for boys and men to reimagine and re-engage with these little secret convos. Like, everything around sex, especially with men, seems so secretive. Even talking about penises is like, ugh, you know, talking about masturbation, you know, there's no cultural, no television, no film, no nothing points about sexual maturity, development, like barely anything. Even in boyhood, I can't remember there being a massive amount about the boy actually confronting his own sexual maturation or penis or masturbation or, I don't know.
Don't you think we've made progress on that?
Well, maybe theatre, actually, sorry, which is, again, for some people that seems like out of reach, but big series. Okay, I would love you to give me one example of a TV show.
I can't, I was just thinking.
Yeah, there isn't. My point is it's, you know, the reason why I think these boys will operate and engage with something as extreme as some of the porn we see in private is because where's the space to discuss it outside of it?
It's also that that's both the first thing they come across and it becomes the norm. I just want to give our listeners and our viewers some really striking stats. So Lad Bible, who are the people behind this campaign, did a survey. It's a big survey. It's 5,300 18 to 29 year olds. And some of the stats are really striking. So porn is the number one sex educator for Gen Z. 70% of men report that porn was their first exposure to sex. Porn consumption, and this is the thing I think which is the most alarming, it's the impact that the digital world is having on the real world.
Yeah.
Porn consumption is changing real-life sex. So 76% of Generation Z have wanted to try something they saw in porn, and 64%, nearly two-thirds, say influences what turns them on. Yeah. It's literally having real-world consequences. But where this gets really dark, and this was recent stats in The Economist, was where people basically have a view of sexual intercourse and they think really abnormal things are normal. Abnormal things like choking.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a bit of research from McGill University in Canada where they found a startling increase in the prevalence of choking, hitting and forced gagging in the most viewed pornography videos, right? A sharp rise in the amount of violent behaviour, choking, and choking is not okay. And then what they really find, which is extraordinary, is how in the real world, more than 40% of women aged 25 to 29 say they've been choked by their partners. Now, I find that, you know, I'm 42, you know, I'm definitely of a kind of digital first generation. I find that absolutely shocking. It's just one study. I think this one's from Indiana University. 40% of women, 40% of women aged 25 to 29 say they've been choked by their partners. What the hell? If your first thing that you see is creates a connection, an explicit visual connection between, for instance, sex, copulation, intercourse, whatever you want to call it, and choking, you might think that that's what sex is.
We're in a space now where a young boy, right, let's say you watch that at 12 or 11 or whatever it is, 13, who are you going to talk to about that? This is what I mean. I don't have all the answers for this stuff, right? I would like to believe that if in the future I have children, I would create a space where a question like that can at least be floated. It's not like, you know, I don't think, and I understand we would, it's going to be, we've lived so long, I think, with this trickle down from religion that we were so used to this complete cut off from engaging in any, even conversation sexually. We just throw someone a condom and hope for the best. Like now, I think it's important to know that, like, I saw this, what does this mean?
If you were education secretary for a day, mm-hmm. and if you could redesign sex education,
yeah,
mm. what would you do differently? Personally, I'm amazed how little quite old teenage boys know about menstruation and
yes.
periods.
And also vice versa, to be honest. I spoke to a female friend of mine recently. She didn't even realise that balls dropped. Where's the conversation around that? People hitting puberty at different times. People are getting pubes at different times, getting balls at different times. Like, a way in which to discuss this and engage with it, with everybody in the class, in a way where it's not like, it's like, yeah, this is it. You're going to have to sit in this discomfort and understand it.
Okay, so that's
consent, all of these things.
Some of the things you're talking about require cultural corrections, and some of them require kind of political corrections. So politically, you could come up with a policy. We're going to do a lot more sort of sex education. But on the cultural thing, in a sharp increase in the consumption of pornography, which is about to be hyper-accelerated by AI,
yeah,
and for a lot of people, it's their first exposure to sex. People saying the tech companies need to do more.
Yeah. Mm.
So technology is fast, regulation is slow. And so when we think about, I just want to like push you a little bit to say, what do we actually do about this?
Ultimately, there are opportunities, like I said, for AI to be used in the reverse instead of mobilizing people and satisfying desires they don't have the language. This is what I need to be clear about. Like, every human being has a shadow side. We all have dark thoughts, we all have dark feelings, and that's okay. Right? We are.
That's what you do with them.
Yes. Our job is, you know, I'm very much a follower of kind of Jungian philosophy in this way, where we have to integrate that into our being and make a healthier choice in the knowledge that we have that shadow side. If we are to ignore it, or if we are to completely feed it, I don't think the how it manifests is good for society, right? But why are we not using the AI to safeguard people, children, from the potential terrors of something like porn? I don't know.
That was Jordan Stevens from the band Rizzle Kicks. You can hear much more of that conversation, of course, by searching for Radical with the Mole Rajan on BBC Sounds, or indeed if you want to watch it on BBC iPlayer. The time now is 17 minutes to 9. We're going to talk about deep sea mining. What is the impact of deep sea mining on the deep seas? Because research by the Natural History Museum into the impact of deep sea mining suggests it might decrease biodiversity by up to 37%. Of course, the deep seas are known to be hugely rich in rare earth minerals, which is powering so much modern technology. Let's talk to Professor Adrian Glover, lead author of the report that's out today, and an ocean scientist. Professor Glover, good morning.
Good morning.
Just take us through the main findings of your research, would you?
Well, I mean, you introduced it very well. It's an astonishing thing. In the middle of the Pacific Ocean, between Hawaii and Mexico, is a vast region of the seafloor, depth 4,000 to 5,000 metres deep. It's cold, completely dark, but it's covered with a layer of these potato-sized mineral accretions, rich in the cobalt and nickel and other potential minerals of interest. But it's also a reservoir of biodiversity. It's dominated by little animals such as worms, clams, crustaceans, living in it's a muddy environment. But on top of that mud is a layer of these potato-sized nodules. And our paper, we've documented this biodiversity in incredible detail, actually. So we've created a baseline of what lives there. But in addition, we undertook effectively independent assessment of the first major test of a modern deep-sea mining machine in terms of its impacts on the biodiversity, which you mentioned, and the abundance of the animals there.
Right, but forgive my ignorance, but I'm just trying to think about how some of our listeners may perhaps think of the deep-sea. We're often told that the whole thing about the deep-sea is that it's so unexplored. There's so much we don't know about the deep-seas. Given there's so much we don't know, how can we measure the biodiversity loss?
So in this particular scenario, there was a mining company, the Metals Company. In October, November 2022, they did a pretty large-scale test of a giant vacuum cleaner, if you like. It drives up and down the seabed, hoovering up these little mineral nodules. And we were able to go in, not only measure the biodiversity before that, but also after that. And that's where we were able to take samples. So, you know, scientists deal in numbers. You know, we found, you know, that 37% decrease in the abundance and a 30% roughly decrease in biodiversity. We didn't see a particularly large impact of a sediment plume. These are all things that have been talked about in a sort of conjecture, a lot of precaution, a lot of conservation strategies for these regions, as you say, because of the absence of evidence of what's there have been precautionary for very good reasons.
But now we can move to a status where we actually have actual useful data, useful numbers. Move on.
And very briefly, if I may, Professor Glover, given the geopolitics of this and given the thirst for these metals in particular, it's quite hard to stop it, isn't it?
Well, that's right. I mean, the first question is, do you need the minerals? I mean, resource geologists say we do, in which case the decisions need to be made on where you get them. So if we go down that route, there's an environmental impact wherever you mine. I think science doesn't tell you which path to choose. We just say what the impact would be under scenario A, B or C. And a 10,000 square metre deep sea mine would obviously impact that area very significantly. 20 of those would be 20 times the impact. You know, so we can't really do that. What science can do is say what the impact is and how you might enable protection, for example, in protected areas around the mined areas. So that's probably the next stage to try to get that right if we get to go down this path.
The messy area of politics. Professor Adrian Glover, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
It's 14 minutes to nine now. So Keir Starmer said at the start of the week that the government would focus on its relationship with China, saying that the UK can't keep blowing hot and cold on the issue. This comes at the same time as an MI5 alert to MPs and parliamentary staff, warning them about being targeted by Chinese spies, and another delay just in the last day or two to whether to greenlight a huge new Chinese embassy building in London was due this month. Now it's been pushed back to January. So what should the UK-China relationship look like? Well, Dan Wong is author of Breakneck, China's Quest to Engineer the Future, and research scholar at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. And Peter Frankopan is professor of global history at the University of Oxford, and author whose books include The Silk Roads. Good morning, both.
Good morning.
It is a fascinating debate, isn't it? And I suppose, Dan, that way that Sir Keir Starmer has summed it up is fairly accurate, actually. This idea of blowing hot and cold, that the UK can't quite decide whether it wants to be friend or enemy.
That's right. So Keir Starmer mentioned that it used to be a golden age with China. Now it has been a little bit of an ice age. And so there has to be a bit of a discussion about how much to value commerce and trade and business ties and how much to really value the security risks.
Mm. Peter, I mean, again, Sir Keir Starmer talked about, he said that they reject a binary choice, but in some ways it is quite a binary choice as to whether you trust somebody, ultimately, whether you are going to let them invest in infrastructure or whether you actually don't trust somebody at all. It's fairly binary, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, that's why books like Dan's are so important. I mean, part of the problem is there's a massive asymmetry in knowledge about China here in the UK, both at political level, but also through business. I mean, one of the reasons for that is that China's been extremely good at embedding itself in global supply chains while keeping everybody else out of its own ecosystems. So, you know, as one simple example, there are more foreigners living in Berlin than there are living in the whole of China. So it means finding people who actually know what they're talking about is very difficult. So being able to lift the bonnet and look underneath to see what areas you can cooperate in, as Dan was saying, are there areas of business that are national security issues and can you define them? So there is an issue about how do you trust, but you do that through learning, through knowledge and through levels of exchange where you keep your conversations open. And I think that's one of the challenges I think we have here, not just in the UK, but in Europe and arguably in the West as a whole, where those discussions with China have not been particularly fruitful in the last 5 or 6 years.
Yeah. Do you think there's a chance, Dan, of them opening up more?
I think that there is always a tension, and I think that there is always some room to negotiate. Even in the matter of trust, I wonder if, sometimes we trust our business partners more and a little bit less. Sometimes we trust our friends a little bit more and a little bit less. And so there is always a room for negotiation. Now, what I believe is always true about China is that we have to acknowledge two central facts about the country. The first is that it has been astonishingly economically successful, pulling over a billion people out of poverty, a few hundred million people into the middle class, a few million people into the recognizable global elites, at the same time that it has grown much more repressive in politically novel ways and has been much more hostile in some ways towards the rest of the world. And so we have to acknowledge both of these facts, that there has been a lot of economic growth. At the same time, it has gotten nastier, frankly, towards its own people as well as the rest of the world. And we just have to balance both of these things.
Do you think there's a point in time at which China will feel that economic supremacy gives it the confidence to be, you know, to let up on some of the other things and to be more open?
Well, I think that it does have the confidence, and sometimes arguably it has the overconfidence. And when it is overconfident, we have seen that top leader Xi Jinping has made various mistakes when he feels like he has the upper hand. For example, when he smacked around Jack Ma of Alibaba, that has really severely weakened economic confidence across the board. And that is one of the causes of China's economic malaise today.
And Peter, when I mean, a lot of the framing at the moment is what is in it for the UK, but actually what is in it for China? What do they gain from good UK relations with the government going forward?
Well, I guess there are two answers. One is, you know, Britain is a permanent member of the Security Council. We're a G7 economy. We've got a significant convening power. We generally behave when we stick to international law. And I think that there are lots of reasons why Britain is an important part of the global architecture. Having said that, you know, it reminds me a little bit of the 1793 expedition that Lord Macartney led to the Qing dynasty. And it's a slight mistranslation, but broadly speaking, the Qing emperor said to him, said that you and the United Kingdom have got nothing at all that China wants or needs. And I think that that's not just an issue for the UK or for Europe. It's in a world where you're thinking about digital architecture. You know, the United States and China go head to head, and in Europe, we're behind the story on all of that when it comes to rare earths, deep sea mining, when it comes to some of the things that you were talking about with Paul Nurse this morning too. It's very hard to see Europe doing anything except sliding down the cliff face. So there are lots of ways in which we could be thinking strategically about where we could influence, where we could gather things together. But, you know, your question now to Dan about China and its confidence, I mean, in the worlds that I work on in Central Asia and around the world, the story is that China wants to try to discuss with partners and build partnerships, where the United States is the great disruptor, wanting to use coercion, particularly economically, to get its own way. And that's part of a narrative, I suppose, because China doesn't behave always in the way that it says that it's doing in terms of the Global Security Initiative or the Belt and Road Initiative. These kinds of things are more complicated than they might sound. But I think for a lot of people, particularly in the Global South, as we were hearing with India, see the world in very, very different kinds of terms. And in that sense, we in the UK could be quite a good horse whisperer. We could be find a way to explain and navigate the pitfalls. But I think that our own lack of confidence and our own lack of expertise is an issue. So the last British Prime Minister to visit Beijing was Theresa May in 2018. Since then, China's economy has grown by almost 2/3. So when Starmer goes there, probably at the end of January, that's an opportunity to reset some of these things. But we need to know what it is that we want. And that I think, is a problem.
Yeah, it is a fascinating discussion. Thank you both, Peter Frankopan, Dan Wong. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. It is 7 minutes to 9 now. With a look ahead to today's Desert Island Discs, here's Lauren Laverne.
My castaway this week is the wildlife filmmaker Gordon Buchanan, who says working in remote locations taught him a valuable life lesson.
I learnt about, I suppose, the benefits and beauty of solitude. And I never find myself alone and think, I really need to be around people right now. But I often find myself surrounded by people thinking, I really need to be alone right now.
Gordon Buchanan, My Castaway. Do join us to hear his Desert Island Discs this morning at 9. Flying on your motorcycle, watching all
the crown. Very much look forward to that, and we've been very much looking forward to this, because it is just coming up to 6 minutes to 9, and in the last couple of minutes, I have raced up to the top of Old Broadcasting House to a studio called ATA, because we're about to end this week's programmes with, or today's programme, with some music. One of the greatest living pianists, Lang Lang, is in London for a pop-up concert in a hospital later today as part of a project called Music Heals. The clue is in the name. The idea is to use music to offer emotional support through workshops and interactive sessions, including for children, through the Lang Lang International Music Foundation. By the way, such is the wholly justified popularity of this Chinese superstar that we have made the decision, which I think he will support, not to be too specific in providing details regarding timings and location, because we don't want to be responsible for a flash mob. But joining us in Studio ATA is the world-renowned pianist Lang Lang. Good morning.
Good morning.
Wonderful, yeah. Wonderful to see you. Thank you so much for coming in.
Such a pleasure.
And for doing this. We're going to end with a bit of music from you. Before yes. we do that, you've spent many years working with children, including children who are facing a range of health problems. What have you found about the power of music to help them?
We've been very lucky to work with many kids around the world who's having some sort of problems. And somehow music is really the best medicine, in a way, that especially for kids who's having autism. For example, I had many students, 6 or 7 students. They weren't talking to anybody. They were just locking themselves into some place. And then when they start playing piano, everything changes. And now I have one of my students who's completely beautiful. I mean, and he's like talking to everyone. He's now teaching piano. Like, he's like teaching not only in kids who's having autism, but like a regular kid.
And teaching piano. It's interesting. Yeah. There are some very well-known stories attached to you about how hard you were pushed as a child.
Yeah.
And, you know, the amount of training and teaching that you endured. What do you think makes a good piano teacher?
A good piano teacher has to really listen to what the students need and to really open their heart and try to inspire them to play with the genuine heart and also to play with joy, you know. And very often in the process of making music, after you play, you practice so much, then you become a machine, you know.
Yeah,
and then we always need to put the human side
well
first.
Just on that point, you're supporting a project called Music Heals. Have you found that music heals you as well?
No, absolutely. When I travel, particularly, I get sometimes real problems. You know, like I don't have a patient, I get really angry, you know. But then when I start playing some beautiful music by Bach or Chopin, it just come back to a wonderful mood.
Well, funny you should mention that. It's a real pleasure for us to have you in London, and it's wonderful of you, kind of you, to join us on the Today programme. You're going to close this morning's programme with a bit of music. Just tell us what it is, and then please take it away.
I know Christmas is coming, so I have a first time. Actually, I'm playing really first time for the public. O Holy Night.
Wonderful. Yeah. Lang Lang, it's over to you.